what's the new song that I gotta sing? You got over me.
Thank you so much for checking out The Core on the Envision Radio Network, copyright 2014.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know, the revolution starts now.
This is Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF.
That's 248-544-9743.
Or text the riff at 4WRIF.
That's 4-9-7-4-3.
Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, and Julene Jordan, welcome back. Happy birthday
thank
to you.
Thank you, Peter.
Everybody was saying happy birthday to Julene.
Thanks, yeah. Everybody. Yeah. You know, it's my birthday usually doesn't fall on a Night Call night. I was like, you know what?
It does every 7 years.
Yes, right. Well, I'm in my 16th
like
with you.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's only twice.
Not too bad.
Don't let it happen again. Hey, this is a phone-in talk show, and we get your opinions on the events of the day. You can call us at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/nightcall. We take your emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It's funny how the big stories are interesting to Americans, but I don't think we're doing much more than passively looking at them. For instance, in Crimea, fireworks exploded, Russian flags fluttered above jubilant crowds Sunday after residents of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and join Russia, back where they started, because Crimea was part of Russia. And in 1954, Khrushchev said, here, you can have Crimea.
It's all yours.
Yeah, but still kept its Black Sea fleet there, and still is there. And it's
but we will be watching.
So this is, and of course, the European nations and the United States have their our shorts in an uproar about it, and a little conflicted about it. You know, it depends on whose secession it is. Like, if it's Kosovo seceding from Serbia, we're all for it. If it's the southern states seceding from the United States,
for it. Come on.
That's modern. Yeah.
Texas, bye-bye.
But, yeah, but back...
Alabama, see you later.
Bye-bye. Yeah, but back then, it caused quite a ruckus. So I don't know really how to cut this. In many ways, there's no good guys in this. Every side has its reasonable argument, and every side has its sort of guys that you just don't want to stand next to. I mean, for one thing, with these folks that kicked out the constitutionally elected president of Ukraine, Yukanovich, I'm trying to remember his name. That was it, wasn't it? Yukanovich? Yeah, okay. How fast you forget. He's gone. But in any event, this has brought into the government of Ukraine now the first openly fascist, politicians since World War II.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, these guys...
Going the wrong way.
Yeah. They call themselves this Svoboda... I got to get this right. Svoboda.
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 Yeah, Svoboda.
Svoboda, yeah.
Svoboda, yeah. Founded in 1991 under the name Socialist Nationalist Party of Ukraine. If you kind of flip those words, it's National Socialist, which in German and shorthanded is Nazi, right? Mm. And they have made all sorts of anti-Semitic remarks. The party's antecedents go back to World War II with the Ukrainians that fought with the Nazis. That joined the Nazis with when they invaded Russia, so it's pretty ugly. On the other hand, the West, rather, moving right up to the borders of what Russia considers its territory, its spheres of influence, is not the way really to have world peace. On the other hand, what harm is this in a way? I don't know what to say. What if Michigan decided we wanted to join Ontario?
Okay.
And we all voted. I mean, it wouldn't go down. They wouldn't allow it. Right. I mean, for one thing, there's a lot, and that was part of the argument against Southern secession, that there was all this federal property, that they were just going to take all these forts and armaments and other things that the United States thought was theirs, ours. And yet, on the other hand, most of what's in Crimea, right, is Russian and all the fleet and all that. I don't know. It's pretty. One thing that's not confused is the American people do not want to have any direct interference in it. The Republicans, of course, who couldn't care less about anything that's really happening other than their political fortunes, are making a big deal about it because they say this shows that Obama's weak, right? Because he hasn't done anything. Well, maybe you should launch some B-52s and you know, drop some atom bombs on Moscow.
Right, right, into a large city. Yeah.
Yeah. What are they? I don't even understand what they think this is all about. That the United States could do one of the things.
A bunch of warmongering people.
Yeah, and one of the things, of course, they've been saying because of Benghazi.
They're still on that damn thing.
And I would, it's such a non-starter with the American people. Probably 85% of the American people have no idea they know that Americans lost their lives there and there was there mistakes made? Well, it depends on how you cut it. But
they know a headline. That's it.
Yeah, Benghazi. Right. And one of the things, if you just keep repeating it enough times, I suppose, I don't know. But what they think, there'll be some political gain out of it.
Turns out, depends on what side you are.
I mean, I wonder what they thought. I wonder what they thought. When was the year? Was it, I don't have this in front of me, 1984, when the Marine barracks in Beirut was bombed and over 200 Marines lost their lives. I mean, three in Benghazi, or was it four? Three or four in Benghazi. That's three or four too many people. Hundreds. None of those guys were saying, you know, we got to get rid of Reagan. I mean, they were making all sorts of apologies for him.
Yeah, but you know, old Hillary, she's a hot button issue.
Yeah.
She's a woman.
Well, they're trying to cut her off at the pass and undercut support for her right from the beginning. That's kind of understandable. I mean,
else are they going to do? It's predictable.
The cynicism of it all is, you know, not real. Appealing. I don't even have about two sentences to say about this flight 370 that has disappeared.
That is just absolutely bizarre.
I just keep hoping it said somebody like Blofeld. Remember Blofeld?
Blofeld.
Blofeld. Do you expect me to die? No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to die.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm not a Bond.
Did I say that right?
I expect you to talk.
No, I think I said that wrong. Yeah, dude. He's tied up, and he says, do you expect me to talk? He says, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. So Blofeld always had these big plans for world domination.
This whole airline thing is just a mind-boggler.
Yeah, I just hope it wasn't like that one that took off from this guy purposely crashed it into the Atlantic a few years ago. Yeah, I mean, I hope they, like, it's in Kazakhstan, and they finally say, you know, we want $5 billion. You know, in other
I'm
words,
not feeling real positive about that.
No, I think it's, I don't, and I don't
with
know.
All the technology and all of, you know, just think about all the spying technology and drones and just all the different things that our military alone has spent trillions
sure.
developing. We can't find this one plane? I don't get it.
Well, they're going, they've got like over 20 nations searching this enormous area. I mean,
I get that it's a large area.
It literally, I heard one guy on the nightly news today saying that it would be like trying to find one person by air in the United States.
Oh, yeah. And I know, it's huge.
So if this plane just went south towards the Indian Ocean, which next stop Antarctica, it's just a goner. Yeah. But one would, well, I don't know, one could speculate forever what was going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're hearing things about that they're speculating about the pilots right now, right?
Yeah. Hey, have you seen the trailer for this brand new Noah film?
I have not. I've heard about it. I've read about it.
Well, first, they used to make those in Hollywood all the time, The Robe, and I can't even remember The Greatest Story Ever Told. I mean, they were always making these religious films, and many of them, some of them won Academy Awards, like in the 40s. There was some nun or somebody like that, the Song of Bernadette.
I was going to say it was Sound of Music, but that was a
little hilarious. So the fact that religious-themed movies coming out of Hollywood, but it kind of crashed for a while, but now they're back at it. And that Mel Gibson film, The Passion of Christ, I mean, that just rolled in the dough.
Listen, my ex-mother-in-law tried to get me to go see that. I mean, look at me, Peter.
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
no.
I mean, you know, not that I look like a heathen. I'm talking about the face I'm making.
Oh.
I just said, you know, looks a little too gory for me. I didn't want to offend her. She was very, very, very
Oh, I mean, I guess the explicit torture of the Jesus character is really horrific.
Plus, I can't stand Mel Gibson on any level.
I was just, my wife was watching, what's it, The View, and they were all talking about being a little forgiving towards Mel.
No.
No. Well,
sorry.
Okay.
Nor Paula Deen. You're both out. See ya.
Okay. When you cross a line, you're just crossed.
You're done.
Anyway, there's two Noah films being released, and normally that would be the last films in the world I'd want to see because there's always this music and everyone's always kind of looking to the sky. They're pretty boring. This is like a disaster horror film. You know.
Is it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, they're making it into a big.
Like, oh, yeah. $125 million dollar film.
Ooh.
Incredible special effects, which you see in the trailer. And normally, I wouldn't even want to give any notice to this because we're just giving them free publicity.
Not going to go see it. If people want to see it, they're going to see it.
Here's what this is from. The Smirking Chimp. You can go to smirkingchimp.com. They've been around for a long time. They kind of one of these news sites that came up during the Bush era.
The second one.
So it says,
horrible one.
There's two battle lines being drawn. The $125 million Paramount one, inspired by the epic story of courage, sacrifice, and hope. And it stars Russell Crowe, Jennifer Connelly, Emma Watson, and Anthony Hopkins. And then there's a small budget one called Noah and the Last Days. And they're dueling it out. Let's see. Oh, my. The Mel Gibson film brought in $600 million.
Yeesh.
Yeah. The official trailer begins with a long-haired Russell Crowe awakening from a revelatory nightmare, and Crowe says he's going to destroy the world.
I really don't like him either anyway, so.
Yeah. Then it says here, cue world-destroying music. Then an aged, and I mean really aged, Anthony Hopkins tells Crowe, my father says that one day if man continued in his way, the Creator would annihilate this world. I saw water, death by water, says Crowe. More earth-shaking music. It's time for Crowe to build an ark. There are those out to destroy Crowe before he can finish the vessel. Crowe defeats his assailant. So these huge battles because, you know, people are...
Are they going to have all the cute little pairs of animals?
Where was... This was in Turkey, right?
That was real, right?
Yeah, yeah. This was in Turkey. Where did, the kangaroos? How did the kangaroos get on
board? From Australia.
I know. They hopped a long way.
It was a miracle.
Yeah, right. Well... But there was a little bit of panic set in, I think, when the people saw that the water was rising And so how many people were on, how many humans were on the ark? Just two, or was there?
I thought it was just him.
Well, he had to have somebody. I had to have another woman there, at least. I don't know this story. Anybody know this story real well? Because I got some questions. In fact, if there are people that put some stock in this story.
Help us out.
Help us out.
Help a couple atheists out.
248-544-WRIF. I want to tell you about a famous atheist, too.
Other than you?
Bill Maher, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's in. He's been getting heavily criticized for what he said on Friday on his show.
Oh, I missed
this. But let's finish up. So what happens in this film, I get from the trailer, is that people realizing, uh-oh, it's curtains, you know, so they try to rush the arc and all that, but he fights them off. You know, it's like one of those, he used to make these films, what was
it's like, well, in that article, it's like Titanic.
Yeah,
long ago.
But there was one, was not the day the Earth stood still. When Planets Collide, there was a 1950s film called When Worlds Collide, and they were going to send a few people off on these rocket ships, but, you know, people got kind of into a panic mode. So, that was difficult. But anyway, let's see. So, is there anything more on here? Wow. But to hear this other film, the guy that ran the other film, whose name is Comfort, where's his name in here? Oh, yeah, produced by Ray Comfort. He doesn't like this Noah film with Russell Crowe. He says, I'm really upset that Hollywood would make a movie that they say is biblical and yet paint Noah as a psychopath when the Bible says that he was a righteous man. Comfort told One News Now, a news service of the American Family Association, which are these right-wing nuts.
They're awful.
And so for them to say it's biblical is just not true. They're trying to get the Christian and Jewish audience to come to it.
And, wait a minute, they're trying to make the money.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, well,
number
sure.
one.
Yeah. And then let me see what else. The synopsis is straight up scary in the Noah and the Last Days. In the time of Noah, people were going about their daily lives, not mindful of the impending destruction. Like them, are we ignoring warnings of God's coming judgment? And they say, these are the Christian nuts, by the way.
Trying to scare people to church.
Yeah, the Bible gives us clear signs of the last days. Did you know the scriptures, that's an interesting stuff.
Oh, wow.
The scriptures say we will see flippant use of God's name. Flippant use of God's name. Money-hungry preachers and rampant hypocrisy in the church. Okay, that's two. Wars and rumors of war. That's three.
Yeah.
And acceptance of homosexuality. That's definitely happening, except in places where they're happier, like Uganda, where, you know, these Christian right-wingers would be happier.
I was going to say, gay people aren't happy in Uganda.
No, in Uganda and Russia.
No.
What's the last thing? Denial of a global flood.
Oh.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
But
climate change is going to create something, but I don't get global flood.
But surely no educated person could believe that Noah and his ark ever really existed. Wouldn't it be impossible to fit millions of species of animals into one boat? And what evidence is there for a worldwide catastrophic flood? However, what if it did all happen exactly as the Bible says? What would that mean? Who was Noah? And why is the amazing account of his life so relevant to you in the 21st century? It's not me saying this, folks. This is this Christian group. Don't be caught unaware. Time is very short. Will you be ready? What?
Well,
wait a minute.
Ready for what?
There's only one Noah. The rest of us are screwed. Well, here's what Bill Maher said, and these right-wingers and these Christians are going crazy. On Friday, Maher told his HBO real-time audience that God was, quote, a psychotic mass murderer.
Wow.
Yeah. He made the comments during a conversation. No, during a conversation. Tell us what you really think,
yeah,
Phil.
Yeah, tell us, Phil.
On the biblical story of Noah and the upcoming Hollywood version that's about to hit the big screen. Maher said, but the thing that's really disturbing about Noah, isn't that it's silly, it's that it's immoral. It's about a psychotic mass murderer who gets away with it, and his name is God. What kind of tyrant punishes everyone just to get back at a few he's mad at? I mean, besides Chris Christie.
Oh, the governor of New Jersey.
Now, I mean, this is pretty crazy, because, what, he floods the whole world. How many people in the world at that time actually knew there was a Jewish God at that time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh. I mean, people all over the world, the native people, they had their own gods. They had the gods in the tree trunk.
And they still do.
The sacred groves, the earth, the plants, the birds,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
But those are other, so did they just flood those folks out too? I don't know.
I don't know either, Peter.
Yeah.
I won't be going to see this.
Bill Maher continued, hey, God, you know you're kind of effed when you're in a movie with Russell Crowe and you're the one with anger issues.
That's funny.
Conservatives are always going on about how Americans are losing their values and their morality. Well, maybe it's because you worship a guy who drowns babies.
Oh, God. And animals.
Yeah. In addition to believing in God, Mr. Maher said the real problem conservatives face today is the restrictions they put on themselves, not the restrictions enforced by big government. Okay.
Well, and restrictions they put or attempt to put on others and yeah. are successful at when they have are in office.
He says, I'm reminded as we've just started Lent that conservatives are always complaining about too much restraining regulation and how they love freedom, but they're the religious ones who voluntarily invent restrictions for themselves. So, you know what I think? I mean, I know educated, non-conservative Christians and Jews and Muslims. Okay. Let's just stick with the Judeo-Christian thing. So they know that the story of Noah is in the Old Testament, right?
Okay.
But these people, like I say, they're middle class, they're educated, they're very, very liberal and progressive. A lot of them are in the peace and social justice movement and all of that. So I'm wondering... first off, I'd be interested if anybody really thinks this is true as written and how they justify God like wiping out the earth's population because a few people were like fornicating or or what else were they? Had false idols or maybe that was all the native people, but they didn't even get a chance to know. They were just there, you know, like peyote cults, you know, for instance, places, and they were...
That's where you would have been.
...doing ecstatic dances into, you know, into these...
The moonlight. States.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, boy, you see the moon tonight?
Beautiful.
Lovely
Full
night for a moon
beautiful.
Dance. Yeah. But anyway...
we can dance on the way.
So I'd be interested, and the phone's not ringing off the hook about this one, that anybody believes it, that it actually went down like that... and the other hand, if there are, I don't know how you'd say it, people that see it like an allegory.
Okay.
Just treat it. I mean, that's a good fallback, though, because the Bible doesn't say that's an allegory. They say that's what happened.
Yes.
But whatever. Okay. That's no big thing, one way or another.
Yeah, well, you know, I know a lot of people giving things up for Lent, and I always say, why do you got to neglect yourself that way? Why do you got to, you know...
There's a lot of religions, though, that have, what do they call it, restrictions, but there's another word.
Sacrifice.
Yeah, well,
it?
Sort of, yeah. There's, there's a fasting that goes on in the Jewish religion, Muslim.
Yeah.
I'll bet you almost every religion, the major religions, have some aspect of fasting.
Right.
Yeah.
Not this girl.
No.
Mm-mm.
No. I talked to somebody, I said, what'd you give up for Lent? They said, Lent. I don't even know what Lent is.
I don't either.
I think it's maybe, like, there's this, I don't know. I'm not going to guess. Anybody want to tell us?
Help a couple of us out.
248-544-WRIF. All right, let's get back to reality. And so the Republicans, they just blood in the water. They won this special election in Florida. Around Clearwater, where there was a candidate who had recently died in October. Representative C.W. Bill Young held the seat for 40 years, and the Democratic candidate, Alex Sink, a woman who was this incredible candidate and was well-funded and what have you, lost to Republican David Jolly and a lobbyist. Wow. But the defeat here, this is the story. I don't get this at all, why they say this when you... And that's the way the Republicans, that was the Republican narrative, right? The defeat was devastating at a time when Democrats are desperate to change the prevailing storyline that 2014 could cost them the Senate with the House already out of reach. And this was a Republican seat that was replaced by a Republican. So it's this devastating loss. Well, it turned out that Alex Sink lost by 1.9 percentage points.
Oh, my.
So it was pretty close.
Yeah.
Let's see.
That's too bad.
And it says, Tuesday's special election underscored three persistent themes likely to play out around the country. Republicans are more motivated than Democrats. Attacks on the unpopular health care law will dominate many races, and the limitless flood of outside money can easily transform local races into national races. And I think it was something like $19 million got put into this. But here, so this is one thing. An older population, the Republicans had a 13-point advantage in turnout in the district. You know, that would seem to me, if that was the case, that you would read this differently. Like, in other words, the Republicans had a...
Like they would have gotten more votes?
Well, no. That the Republicans had a turnout advantage of 13 percentage points, yet that the Democrat only lost by 1.9.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. So it seems to me they did number of voters almost equally divided between the two main parties, even though, but usually. When there was another point in here as well. $9 million was spent by outside groups like the Conservative American Crossroads, and the Liberal House Majority PAC. Conservatives outspent liberals by $1.3 million. So, you know, what's the old line? Money does not talk.
It swears. Yeah. It screams.
And they're doing stuff like this, and I don't know if you've seen this, but Representative Gary Peters is running for the seat that Carol
Evans... I can't believe these ads are already going on.
Yeah, well, this is all funded by the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, these billionaires that their fortune taken together, I think, would be more than Bill Gates. Maybe not, but it would be right up there in the first one, two, or three. So these billionaire polluters, the Koch brothers industry is the 14th highest polluting industry in the country. And what they want to make sure is that they can keep on doing that.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, we got a couple people.
Inside, out, and all around.
All right, Randy from Westland wants to tell us about Lent, and okay. Brian from Macomb wants to tell us about Noah. But let's just finish this story. So one of the things that the Koch brothers have been putting forth are these phony, essentially lies. I mean, hey, it's politics, right?
You've seen the ads out there.
Yeah.
Of the woman who had cancer.
From Dexter, and it's featured in a conservative group's TV ad, denouncing her new Obamacare coverage as, quote, unaffordable. And it turns out, according to the Detroit News, a conservative paper.
Yeah.
Noah Finley, one of the most obnoxious conservative guys around. He's the editorial page director. So this is no liberal paper. Turns out that her unaffordable insurance will save her more than $1,000 a year.
That woman, I mean, I don't want to say anything about the ill, but she should be ashamed of herself.
Oh, she's not at all. Her name's Julie Boonstra, and it turns out, well, gee, guess who was married to? Ex-wife of Mark Boonstra, the former Washtenaw County Republican chairman, who Governor Rick Snyder appointed to the Michigan Court of Appeals in 2012. So, I mean, so, you know, it's part of this racket.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, without going into all the details, and here's what I don't understand, that the Detroit News and fact-checkers last month cast doubt on the accuracy of the TV ad, and on Monday, Boonstra acknowledged which health plan she chose, offering the first evidence of cost savings. Well, her new plan that she dislikes is the Blue Cross Premier Gold Health Care Plan, which caps patient responsibility for out-of-pocket costs at $5,100 a year, which is lower than the federal law's maximum of $6,350. Now, I mean, forget about all the, this dollar figure and all of that, but she's going to save $1,200 a year. Now, it occurs to me, why in the richest country in the world does anyone have to pay $6,350 a year when they get cancer?
Yeah.
You would think that the government, given what they're suffering, ought to say, what do you need? How can we help you?
Like Canada and all those other countries.
Yeah, so that's what she should be on about.
But of course she's not.
How about this? Her old plan, and she wanted this one, costs $1,100 a month or $13,200 a year. So this is a lady with some money.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And who can afford that?
Because that's a better plan.
Yeah.
Right?
But,
yeah, there's gold, silver, bronze.
So now she's going to pay $571. So she's getting this bargain under Obamacare. And she said,
going on TV.
When advised of the detail of her blues plan, Boonstra said the idea that it would be cheaper can't be true. I personally do not believe that. Well, I personally may believe that I'm the Prince of Wales. It doesn't matter what you personally believe. I mean, what do they say? Everybody has their right to their own opinion, but you don't have your right to your own facts.
But yeah, and to blatantly lie. I mean, I remember the first time I saw that commercial, I'm like, wow, you know, this seems like an actual real person. What's going on? And then I soon figured it out, and I just...
Well,
every time it comes on, I think of all the people who she's getting to believe her.
Yeah, her oncologist said that he understands the new plan is, quote, very confusing, but Boonstra said Monday she's seeking a detailed contract from Blue Cross. I really can't comment on the numbers when I haven't received the statement yet. So why are you figuring in this ad paid for by the Koch brothers to try to eventually deny health coverage to all these millions of people that are going to get it? And believe it, folks, Obamacare is here to stay. It's permanent. There's no way in the world this is going to be repealed. They're going to say, okay, we got all Republicans in here, and we're going to just cancel health insurance for a few million people. I don't think so. They're not going to do that. It's solely an election issue and pulling people's chain. The Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers sponsored deal, and they've put in like almost $500 million into ads attacking Democrats and particularly health care for everybody. And Boonstra says that Representative Gary Peters is trying to silence her. Right. Well, that'd be a good idea. Someone should silence her.
Well, I'm proud of the Detroit News.
The Washington Post fact checker, this is interesting, Glenn Kessler downgraded Boonstra's ad further from 2 to 3 Pinocchios. Wait a minute. Based on the plan information from the news. Wait a minute. Downgraded. Oh, yeah, this was even worse. No, I think it got better. We understand that change can be confusing and that Boonstra was annoyed at having to sign up. Well, yeah, but why would you take part in an ad like that?
I know.
Unless a Republican right-wing operative.
You're in.
All right, let's find out about Lent, and let's find out about Noah. We'll pick that up when we come back.
And I have something to tell about George Zimmerman. We got an email.
Oh, boy. 248-544-WRIF. Right back with more Night Call.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Guys, WRIF.com has everything you desire packed inside the Riff Man Cave. It's the online destination for all things manly. Babes, beer, sports, humor, and more. The Riff Man Cave, brought to you by ABC Harley-Davidson. Man up your desktop now at WRIF.com.
Geico presents Fan Mail to a Pig.
Dear Maxwell, first off, I really enjoy your commercials about Geico's app. I watch them over and over and over. They make me both laugh and very hungry. Weird. Anyway, I just want to let you know how Geico's new claim status updates on the app really blow me away. Getting those updates makes me think of you. I'd like to thank you in person. Just send me your address. All the best, Big Bad W. Sure thing, Big Bad W. I got a pen. It's 802, not gonna happen lane.
Claim status updates just a tap away on the Geico app.
The 2014 Rick Rock Girl Search is on. Ladies, you could be one of our 4 finalists heading off for a photo shoot in Riviera Maya, Mexico at the Grand Bahia Principe Cuba, courtesy of Apple Vacations, and maybe earn a $40,000 salary as WRIF's entertainment reporter in the coolest gig you'll ever have.
Keep listening for details on where our next Rick Rock Girl casting call will be happening. WRIF's 2014 Rick Rock Girl Search, presented by Jose Cuervo Cinch. Get stung.
Learn more online at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. I know you want to tell your George Zimmerman story, and we want to hear about Lent and Noah. We have people waiting. But
you know me, I like to get to the phones.
But wait, I know. You know, I like to get to the phones, but I like to blab my mouth.
Yeah, well.
So I want to say happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone. I guess they had the parade today. They were freezing out.
The coldest one in history.
Is that right?
That's what Everyone knows who Doug Podell is.
You know, my maternal father's side were these Protestant Irish. So on St. Patrick's Day, my grandfather would send my dad and my uncle to school wearing orange, which is, you know, the Protestants are called the orange men, and everybody's wearing green and what have you.
How about that?
Hey,
well,
could...
I'm a whole lot Irish. I'm half Irish, half Norwegian, so.
Why are the Irish always fighting among themselves? Because they have no worthy opponents. That's one of the things. This ties in. I should have done more with this. Both on my website, which is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, there's the story of the St. Patrick's Battalion. The St. Patrick's Battalion was made up of these new immigrants from Ireland that were impressed into the U.S. Army, sent off to a war of aggression against Mexico, which, you know, we stole all this land from them. And they joined the Mexican side, a couple hundred of them, and fought the U.S. Army.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an incredible story. So you can go to our Facebook page, and it's got the Wikipedia story, the St. Patrick's Battalion, and also our favorite singer-songwriter, David Rovics, has a St. Patrick's Battalion song, which I think is one of his best.
I agree, it's one of his best, and around the world when he tours, that is one of people's favorites.
Okay. Boy, you got somebody wants to tell an Irish joke. I don't know if I even want to go there.
Keep
but,
it clean.
All right. But since you want to go to the phone, save your George Zimmerman.
I will. I'm fine with that.
And let's do this. Let's go to Randy. Randy's in Westland. I think he's going to tell us what Lent is. What's Lent?
Lent is the 40 days before Easter that Jesus spent in the desert fasting.
Oh.
So that's why Catholics pick something to give up for the same amount of time.
Wow.
Did you give anything up?
Who, me?
Yeah.
No, not this year.
You know, I'll tell you, then there's Ash Wednesday. When I was a kid, I sold shoes, like when I was about 19, and the district manager came in, and I noticed he's got this smudge of dirt in the middle
of
his forehead.
And he said, "You've got something on your head?"
And so I thought, okay, maybe the guy will go into the bathroom and
see in the mirror.
Yeah, and I see it, he comes out, and I said, you know, Mr. Smith, you have some dirt
Peter,
on your forehead.
I did the same
really?
Thing to someone. Yes, I
but did.
Did
you do it because you didn't know? I didn't know.
I did it because I, well,
you were just messing with it?
No, I wasn't. I was working at my dad's car dealership, and this female salesperson came in, and I said, Jan, you got a little thing up there. And she's like, Jelaine.
It's Ash Wednesday.
I'm sorry.
What's Ash Wednesday? Hold on, Randy. Let me. Chuck Bean called back. He was running Meltdown's The Core show that precedes ours, and he said it was Noah and his family that built the ark. Yeah.
Oh.
Well,
okay.
Wasn't there anybody outside of that gene pool though? But here, let's go back to Randy. Yeah. Did I just ask a question?
What's Ash Wednesday?
Just is to represent, remind you, you from dust you came and to dust you'll return from the earth. And so what they do is Palm Sunday is the day Jesus came into town and they, laid down palms to praise him and stuff. And then 3 days later, of course, they crucified him. That was, so then every year what they do is they recycle the palms, you bring them in, and they burn them and they use the ashes from the palms. It's not really just, representative of, it's just something to do with the palms, and it's something to remind you of, you came from ashes and, or from dust you came, to dust you shall return.
Well, how do you fall on this, like, Noah story? I mean, on the face of it, it doesn't sound like it's what actually happened. It's sort of a metaphor, or do you believe that?
I don't know, because they say they found the ark up in some mountain somewhere, but I don't believe the whole world got flooded, but what might have been called the world at the time, just like at one time all of Europe was considered the world, until they discovered other parts. So, a major area may have been flooded out.
Oh, what, Randy? That's right. I have heard that. That is one of the explanations, that in fact it was a flood that occurred in a particular part of the world and that it was just sort of expanded. Okay, well, thanks for that information.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Now we know.
Now I'm beginning. Some of this is starting to come back to me. Here's,
yeah, me too.
Brian.
I did all this, some of it as a kid.
I never did.
Well, I was forced to.
Yeah. Here's Brian in Macomb. Brian, hi. You're on the air.
Hey. Hey, how's it going, Peter and Julie?
Good.
Hi, Brian.
I got to be honest, I actually haven't heard you guys' show before, but I've been listening for the past while, and, you know, I love what you guys are doing, what you're saying, and I think people need more shows like you, because this Bill O'Reilly, Fox News, everyone's just polluting people's minds with lies and everything. But anyways, besides the point.
Thank you.
Yes, no problem. I grew up Catholic, and, you know, I kind of, a lot of the stories are very hard to believe, but and, you know, I do believe in a higher power. I don't know if I'd consider myself completely Catholic anymore, but either way, I was watching a thing on the History Channel or some channel like that. I don't know if I can say all these names and stuff, but, you know, something on TV, History Channel, Discovery, whatever. And they're saying that they did some research and some explorers went out or whatever, and they went to the Black Sea out in, what is that, Europe?
Yeah, right by Crimea. Actually,
right. So, yeah. And they went in the Black Sea, and there's like a channel that goes there from whatever ocean it is, and they did sonar and all this stuff, and they're saying that the Black Sea used to be a fraction of the size, and they found saltwater specimens, they found a shoreline, and they believe that Noah's Ark probably is more of a metaphor. That's why I believe it's a metaphor, but there was a major flood thousands of years ago. And, you know, people in that day, like that one guy before me said, you know, the world to them was such a small place. They didn't know the whole world. They just thought the world was where they were. And
sure.
They were thinking, you know, that's probably what it is. You know, they thought it was the Black Sea. It was a fraction of the size. It was fresh water. So there's sediments all around this lake, and it flooded, and I'm sure a bunch of people died, and someone must have wrote a story about it, and
there you go.
Here we are today.
The rest is history.
Maybe I need to quit denying any aliens.
that's the ancient aliens is on a lot, yep.
All right, Brian, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And they're actually, this guy, he was just got a little bit of play just recently, Ken Ham. He runs the Creation Museum down, is it in Kentucky, isn't it? He just had an interview with the science guy, Bill Nye. All these.
I heard about this. In fact, someone we work with encouraged me to watch it.
Who did they think?
The debate.
Which person did they think you'd be convinced by the strength of whose argument?
I think more Bill Nye.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good, good. Yeah, because it's kind of a strange debate.
Because, the guy Bill Nye debated was just kind of like, well, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
That was his type of answer. He gave no facts.
Well, it's based on faith.
Right.
Yeah. Ken Ham, let me put it this way. The atheist and agnostic community was really angry with science guy Bill Nye for agreeing to this debate, because everybody knows, or not everybody, but great numbers of people know who Bill Nye is, but nobody knew who this...
Well, you know a lot of people, how they know who he is?
What,
he was on the last Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, that's right. The new one, my wife's all excited. There's a new one starting tomorrow.
Oh, my.
And they got Olympic winners are going to be there, competing against one another.
Oh, yeah, the ones that practice here.
Yeah.
In Michigan, that won.
Yeah, that won, right. And isn't that kind of unfair?
Dancers.
Yeah.
I think it's extremely unfair when you have ice dancers.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, who cares? I don't watch that crap.
So Creation, I won't tell.
Don't tell
my wife.
Your wife.
No. Creation Museum founder Ken Ham announced Thursday that a municipal bond offering has raised enough money to begin construction of the Ark Encounter project, estimated to cost $73 million. They're going to build this replica of the Ark.
Yeah.
Yeah, groundbreaking planned for May. The Ark is expected to be finished by the summer of 2016. He also runs the Creation Museum, a highly successful tourist destination, and it's going to be 40 miles south of Cincinnati. Hmm. Okay.
It'll be close.
Yeah.
Road trip.
We could do it. Here's Big B. Big B, you're on the air. Are you back in Detroit?
No, I'm still out here in California.
Okay, all right. But you can take the boy.
His heart's always here.
Yeah, you can take the boy out of Detroit. Right, but so you want to? I didn't think anybody would talk about the Malaysia flight. What did you think about it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you the truth. I think somebody's got him. I hope they got him.
safe, and I think they're going to use that plane. It's going to show up like it did before somewhere too late, and be used as a weapon somehow, maybe with a dirty bomb or the whole plane going into a building or whatever, the same scenario as before. Could be a possibility. And also, I mean, the CIA was behind 9/11. We know that because they took Bin Laden's sisters out of Iran the day before the whole thing happened. The CIA didn't tell the FBI what was going on. The CIA knew the whole time. We're finding out all kinds of stuff now about that, the NSA, and all kinds of people knew what was going on, and it was just not one person telling the other person what was going on, basically. And some slightly crazy stuff going on there. I don't know. It's like creating attention somewhere else. With this Putin thing, I believe it's a strategic location, really. Is there a way of getting in somehow, the CIA putting something up to, as to, I'm just hoping that's what it is. But, you know, it could be they got all, they perished it over the water. But there's something strange. And the only thing is, though, how all those people are still quiet and haven't contacted anybody is strange. You know,
that's their cell phone. Well, you know, Big B, yeah. If I didn't know better, I'd think you were a stoner.
Yeah, the aliens are coming, you know. No, anyway, the hash bash is on the 5th, and I just want to tell you.
April,
that.
Yeah, on the Diag, and somebody's got to remind me. Do you use the internet? Do you use the email? All right, would you email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and say, Peter, remember to play the hash bash song. I've neglected it for the last couple of years or so. It's a great little song.
That'd be great. Are you going to show up like you did a couple of years ago before? Or?
Well, maybe. We used to show up with Drew and Mike and Trudy, and we were down on the Diag with John Sinclair and Chef Ra from High Times. And
remember Will? Yep, he passed away.
Had us a time. Yeah, are you going to be in for it?
Yes, I'll be there. I'm just finishing up with some ear surgery. I had an infection in my ear from Michigan 6 months ago, and now it's coming to an end, but yeah, I'll be there.
I heard you need a good clove of garlic in your ear to clear up an infection. You could have just stuck a clove of garlic in there, Big B.
There you go. There you go.
All right, Big B, we'll see you on the Diag. For those of you who may not have heard of this or live in some other part of the universe, hey, what happened to the guy that had, maybe we shouldn't, had another Irish joke, but sometimes, you know, they can be derogatory.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. The Irish, by the way, were a discriminated against minority for the longest time. Signs up that said no Irish need apply. They were thought to be the lowest scum, particularly like in New York, and given to crime. I mean, all
gangs
in New York, all the stereotypes. I mean, that happened. Every immigrant group that would come along, they would say, you know, and it was Jews at one time in the 1890s. The police chief of New York said that they were, what was his word, like inherently criminal.
I can think of a few groups of people who are still discriminated against.
Yeah, so it goes
today,
up. Yeah,
today.
Always the marginalized group. Some groups are kept permanently marginalized.
Peter, you have to let me tell
this
story.
Oh, what about George Zimmerman?
Okay.
Sorry.
And first I'm going to tell the story, and then I'm going to go back and thank who sent it to us. Thank you for sending it to us. Acquitted murderer George Zimmerman. Are we tired of talking about this a-hole yet? He is the one who shot and killed Trayvon Martin 2 years ago. Can't believe it.
Yeah.
He was signing autographs at a gun show, shaking hands in Orlando, the new Orlando gun show. Can you believe the nerve of this
what
guy?
What a repulsive human
what
being.
But the good news. Yeah. I have good news. Fewer than 20 people showed up to get a free Zimmerman autograph in over 6 hours.
Wow.
So to those 20 people, I loathe you.
Yeah, you would.
And that's from Stephen. Thank you, Stephen, for writing that in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
If everything George Zimmerman said was true about that incident where he shot to death this unarmed teenager who had his hands filled with candy and iced tea, even if everything he said was true, and, I mean, think about, you know, the more I think about this, I was thinking, what did happen? All of a sudden, this kid is walking down the street. One hand, he's got Skittles. The other hand, he's got iced tea. And he says, I got an idea. Let's attack this grown-up man. right? And tries to kill him. All right, let's say that's all true. Wouldn't this be in the world of a normal human being so unfortunate, so unhappy, so disturbing that you would want never...
You couldn't live with yourself.
Or even, listen, if someone tried to kill me and I killed them, I could live with myself very easily. I'm saying, given what that if we grant everything that George Zimmerman said was true, which I think the hunt was 180 degree opposite, is what occurred. But wouldn't you just, I don't know. I mean, you wouldn't want that kind of prominence unless you were a murderous type, and then you would be kind of proud of it. Then
and
you would
angry,
go to gun show, yeah,
and a gun nut.
Yeah.
By the way. Jim wrote in and said, hey, Peter, and to us, there had to have been a flood. That's how the flying spaghetti monster was created. If this doesn't make sense to you, Google flying spaghetti monster. And okay. He said, thanks for thinking. Thank you.
Hey, speaking of gun nuts, a northeastern Pennsylvania man has pleaded guilty to posting an online threat to kill the president. Nicholas Savino pled guilty. They say pleaded. Maybe, I don't even think pled.
It is.
Pleaded. I don't think pled is a word
it's
even.
It's not.
Okay.
I remember this from my news reporting days.
So, posting a thread on the White House website last August, he wrote, President Obama, the Antichrist. As a result of breaking the Constitution, you will stand down or be shot dead. The 42-year-old, he lives in Clark Summit. He's going to be sentenced on June 11th. He faces up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Okay. Under the plea agreement, he pled guilty. Now, I'm sure this is going to really trouble the NRA. He's going to forfeit his three guns and about 11,000 rounds of ammunition that he had that he found in his apartment and in his car. Savino was arrested about a week after posting the threat. And, of course, it doesn't say this here, is that Nicholas Savino was a law-abiding citizen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because all these guys, they're always a law-abiding citizen until they start doing stuff like that.
Until they're not.
Did I try to remember, maybe he had these. This will really, the gun nuts are probably have to have a box of Kleenex sitting by them.
Not because they're crying.
No, not by their crying. Another secretion.
Oh, God,
wow.
Yuck.
Yeah, a newly developed bullet from G2 Research is being billed as the last round a gun owner will ever need. A smashing hunk of copper with full metal jacket power to shred through solid objects and stop attackers in their tracks. G2R, the Windsor, Georgia company that created the radically invasive projectile, RIP.
Projectile.
Says the bullet is like a full metal jacket when it strikes and it's designed to, quote, take out all your vital organs. Man, this is probably better.
I mean, if I'm going to take someone out, I'm taking all their damn organs with them, okay?
Right. That this is probably better than Viagra for these guys.
Just tune in to Peter and Julina and talk about big guns.
Yeah. The president of the company said, I wanted to create a round that would work well against a home intruder. There were so many stories out there about a woman trying to defend her home and having to shoot someone five or six times, and they'd still come after her. We wanted to create an effective one-shot man stopper. You know, this was like in the 1930s that one of they said that crazed Mexicans and crazed Negroes on marijuana, no matter how many times you shot them, they would keep coming at
that
you. This is really a reflection of that.
What do they think they are? Freaking zombies?
Okay, we got some more info we need. Actually, we never even said our friend, our colleague, our assistant producer Jefferson's name.
Jefferson! Here every week taking your phone calls.
At 248-544-WRIF.
Gets the podcast together for us so we can post it on Mondays.
Yep.
For all of you who are listening to the podcast as this is recorded and played back every week, hello to you too.
Yeah. The bullet is made with trocar angles. Okay. Jefferson, you can kind of look that up. Trocar, T-R-O-C-A-R. Oh, edges with three angles that lead into a single point, which enabled to cut through an object's layers with greater speed and blah, 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 blah. It is capable of going through barriers such as sheetrock, plywood, sheet metal, or glass and still perform its original intent.
Oh, my God. What happened to the old Wild West?
Yeah, I thought this was a guy that was coming through your door. No, it just maybe the bullet shreds through solid objects and can only then expand its energy. All right, let's do this. Andrews in Manchester wants to talk about Zimmerman, and Jason in Ipsy wants to talk about the Malaysia flight. We'll get that when we're back.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call.
And now, another great hit from Flo. Discounts from Progressive are good.
Why is a strike bad in baseball if it's good in bowling? And then someone told me about a basketball strike. That sounds bad, but I'm not quite sure. But I think we all can agree it's good to get discounts from Progressive.
Progressive offers lots of discounts to help you save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states.
Get everything that rocks on your smartphone. Dave and Chuck the Freak, The Rock Girl, The Riff Man Cave, and more. Oh, yeah, you can listen live, too. Download the 101 WRIF app for your iPhone or Android today from the App Store or Google Play Store. Brought to you in part by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Specs Howard's one-year programs in graphic design, broadcast, or digital media arts sharpen your creative edge. Find out more at SpecsHoward.edu or call 248-358-9000.
I'm a professional drunk driver. I know how to get home after drinking. How? I take the side streets.
I turn off the radio.
I don't speed.
Or wear a hat.
I stay out of the fast lane.
I drive with the windows down.
I keep both hands on the wheel.
I just focus really hard.
I don't pass.
Don't tailgate.
I'm going to stop you right there. As a police officer, I've heard all the excuses. I know all the so-called tricks. If you drive drunk, I will find you, catch you, and arrest you. We've stepped up enforcement and put more officers on the streets, so trust me when I tell you we're cracking down on drunk driving. You don't want to get thrown in jail, lose your license, and pay a bunch of legal fees. So don't drive drunk, and you won't get a DUI. Because bottom line, if you drive drunk, with or without your hat on or while taking side streets, I'll catch you. Drive sober, or get pulled over.
A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
GEICO presents Fan Mail to a Pig.
Dear Maxwell, I just want to say thank you for making my GEICO insurance ID card digital. It's easy to find on the app. It doesn't give me paper cuts, and I always have it on hand because it's on my phone. Because of this, I finally cleaned out my glove box, which was filled with years of paper ID cards. Any thought on what I should put in my glove box now? Sincerely, Trent Patterson. Trent, what can you put in the glove box? Here's a crazy thought. How about gloves?
Digital insurance ID cards, just a tap away on the GEICO app.
If you've got 15 seconds, GEICO could help you be a better driver.
If you're being tailgated, slow down and let them go by. Don't hit the brakes suddenly. It's against the law and very dangerous. And tapping your brake lights is almost as bad. You're simply training the other driver not to take your brake lights seriously. If something actually happens and you do hit the brakes, the tailgater's reaction time may be longer because he's thinking you're just tapping your brakes again.
Manage your policy, get roadside assistance, and more. Just a tap away on GEICO's free mobile app.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
everything that rocks. RIS Dave and Chuck the Freak for a St. Patrick's Day live broadcast tomorrow from Dooley's in Roseville. Doors open 6 a.m. Green beer, huge tent, Irish food and entertainment. Dooley's, Gratiot, north of 13 Mile in Roseville. Details at WRIF.com.
Full volume.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
High fidelity stereophonic sound.
Everything that rocks.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the list award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
I love it. 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, Facebook.com/Night Call. And thank you, Jefferson, for getting up on screen this horrible bullet, this RIP. Usually means rest in peace. This is radically invasive projectile. This bullet has got to be illegal under the Geneva Conventions. You can't even have dum-dum bullets, let alone this thing. I don't know. Can you see it from here? How would you describe it?
Yeah, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 protruding, big, scary things.
This could put a hole in
you. Coming out of the top of the bullet.
Yeah, 8 inches wide.
Couple emails. Can I talk about those real quick?
Sure.
Okay. Patrick wrote in, Peter and Jalene, as a raised Catholic who attended church every week and Catholic school, I ask, what is so unbelievable about Noah, who was 500 years old, and his sons, who were 100 years old, building a big wooden ship, then getting a male and female species of every animal on earth on that boat and surviving a flood that was made by a spiteful God who wanted to kill everyone, including women and children, because he was so upset with man's behavior. Sounds perfectly logical, doesn't it? And one more really quick, bear with me.
I'm fine.
You know, you're usually the one that I'm telling me to to talk. Anyway, this is by someone unnamed, and this is regarding racism, of which we fight each and every week and each and every day in our personal lives. This is about the Howell High School basketball team. Played Grand Blanc, Michigan on Thursday, and their Twitter and Facebook accounts, et cetera, there were all kinds of racist remarks, horrible remarks. There's a story on M Live.
Who's got the blank players? Or
which
city?
I mean, Howell. It's got to be Grand Blanc.
Yeah, because Howell used to be kind of the home of the Klan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that to our attention, because that totally honks me off. And let's see. Jeffrey wrote in, I remember back in 94, Nicole Brown Simpson's murder being depressing when I saw the verdict on TV. However, I remember seeing crowds of black people in many different locations celebrating. I thought Zimmerman should have been found guilty also. However, I'm still bothered by all the celebrating that went on when O.J. Simpson was acquitted.
Yeah, it was a poor reaction.
It was something.
Yeah, that's a very complicated story.
Yeah.
At 1 a.m., which is in almost an hour, I'm going to be interviewing Alan Wiseman. Alan Wiseman, it's interesting. He told me his name was pronounced Wiseman, although it looks like Weissman. And he was a guest on Bill Maher's show on Friday. And
what did he say his name
Weissman.
Was?
Now,
Wiseman.
That's what Maher
Wiseman
said.
All right.
This is the same show, and this is what some people are responding to about Noah's Ark and how that Bill Maher said, the thing that's really disturbing about Noah is that it's so immoral. It's about a psychotic mass murderer who gets away with it, and his name is God. What kind of tyrant punishes everyone just to get back at a few he's mad at? I mean, besides Chris Christie. But so that's what some of the people are responding to. All right, let's get back to our phones, because there's a lot of you been waiting. So, and the number, 248-544-WRIF. And here's Jason in Ypsilanti. Hey, Jason, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
This missing airplane thing just really blows my mind, and there's so many different things going out, but I wanted to bring up one theory, and I'm sure you probably heard something about it, but I'm really curious to see what your guys' opinion is of it, or if it any facts to back it up, because to be honest, I haven't gone through and checked everything, but there's something floating around about the Rothschild and the four out of five and the, you know, have you heard about it?
No. Well,
what? What's he talking about?
As soon as you hear the word Rothschild, you know you're dealing with crazy right-wing anti-Semites, because Rothschild was this famous European firm of wealthy Jewish bankers, or bankers who happen to be Jewish. You know, some of them are Jewish, some of them are Christian, some of them now are Muslim, some of them are atheists. But there are these wacky people that think that somehow that the religion of one group of people determines their political and monetary behavior, which is just nuts. I mean, if they're bankers, they all act the same. They want to figure out how can they get the most money and screw the little guy. It doesn't matter what their particular religion is. Here, who was Ypsilanti, Jason?
Yes.
Who was Ypsilanti?
That was a question.
It was a question.
I don't know.
Okay. He was
I wasn't born and raised here. I don't know.
Okay, he was a Greek general.
Good question.
Greek general. I forgot what.
Now you know. You can go around town spreading the info.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Forget those conspiracy theories. We don't know what happened. You know, though, all of a sudden, I always ask people that because people often think that Ypsilanti was a Native American. You know, steal their land, kill them all, and then name baseball teams after them.
Okay.
And counties and stuff like that. But I forgot now, Ypsilanti. Okay, Jefferson. I think it was in some Greek civil war, but why would we name a city in Michigan after a general in a Greek civil war?
Peter, there's a little hobby for you, a little project
all
this
right.
week.
Okay, let's see.
You're on it.
Here's Andrew. Andrew is in Manchester. Hey, Andrew, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I was talking about the Zimmerman thing. I just want to say, you know, I grew up around guns. I was in the military. I'm more than well qualified to handle guns and firearms and weapons.
Yeah.
And the number one thing I've always been taught, if you're ever in a sticky situation, the last thing you do is shoot.
Right.
The last thing you should ever do is shoot. You know, what Zimmerman did was completely wrong. It's horrible. A 17-year-old boy lost his life because of that, and his family will never get to see those things that are expected to for them to see in his life.
Yeah.
And what he did was wrong.
He still had a pediatrician, for crying out loud. You know, he was
Is that right?
Yeah.
Trayvon Martin had
He still was seeing a pediatrician. I heard that the other day, and that just really, it didn't take anything more to convince me it was wrong, but it gave it more. You know,
I didn't understand anyway, even if you try to buy the Zimmerman story, I'm like, 5'10 and a half, weigh 170 pounds or something like that.
Depending on the time of year.
Depending on the time of year, yeah. A 15-year-old, how old was he?
17.
17. Well, 17-year-old kids get kind of bigger and kind of tough. But still, Zimmerman caused it because he had a gun when he shouldn't have had it, because watch groups are not supposed to be armed. And the only reason he got out of the car was because he had a gun, because he felt confident enough to do it, because, you know. To confront somebody. And I suspect probably what happened, he said, what are you doing around here? And maybe Martin said, F you, because that's what would occur to me to say to somebody who started saying to me, you know, where are you going? What are you doing?
What business is yours? I'm walking down the street, dude.
And so remember, Zimmerman, too, said these a-holes always get away. So here is we don't know, because Zimmerman killed the only other witness. And he said, you know, he started to walk away. And this is giving the most support possible to the Zimmerman side of the story. And he grabs Trayvon Martin. Well, once that occurs, Zimmerman has initiated a fight, and then all of a sudden winds up on the losing end of it. Perhaps that's the best case scenario you could make for him. And still, he's responsible, as you said, Andrew, for the death of somebody that didn't need to occur, and this guy has no shame, no sense of humanity. And did you want to add a phrase of yours?
I could go on and on and on. Now he thinks he's a freaking celebrity and he's signing autographs.
Didn't get very many. All right, Andrew, thank you very much. Thanks for your experience.
Who would want
appreciate
that, guys?
All right.
Autograph, but a racist.
You know what?
MF. That's all I have to say about
or
that.
Or someone who thought, I might be able to sell this
on
in the
eBay.
Future. Yeah.
And if you want, anyone wants to make money off of that, hey, you can sell whatever you want on eBay. If you want to, that's just disgusting.
Would you get Hitler's
no.
autograph? Well, yeah, but think what you could sell it for now.
Don't care. Rather eat dirt. Hey, I just saw something online that I wanted to bring up since we're talking about St. Paddy's Day, and then we'll get to these phone calls really quick. The makers of the beer Guinness have announced, they announced Sunday, well, now yesterday, that they have withdrawn sponsorship of the New York's St. Paddy's
really because
parade, citing a policy of exclusion because the parade has increasingly come under fire from the gay and lesbian community for not allowing members of the LGBT community to identify as gay, though they are allowed to march. So,
yeah.
Mr. Guinness.
Let's have a Guinness.
Yeah.
Let me see. It's, what is it? Oh, yeah. The slogan of Guinness is tall, dark, headsome.
Oh.
You get that?
Drank it? Mean?
Well, you know, you heard tall, dark, and handsome?
Yeah. No, I get that.
Okay. So it's tall, big glass of beer, dark, it's dark colored, headsome?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
let's move on.
Not very witty to me.
Yeah. Let's move on.
Come up with something better there.
Let's see. Judge Woodward of Detroit was so impressed and fascinated by General Ypsilanti's military success that he named this settlement on the Huron River after the war hero. Okay.
And that's from Jefferson?
Yeah. Thank you, Jefferson.
Thanks, Jefferson.
Yeah. He's become our crack researcher. Taking it away from the listeners, well, it should. It's our job. It's a dirty job. Somebody's got to do it. So open lines for you. Any thoughts? Remember we were asking earlier about this Noah story where it was flooded the whole world. We had a couple people that said that it was either totally, well, I don't think anybody said it was completely metaphorical, but they said that this could have been a regional flood in which great numbers of people died. And it was expanded in that regard into the total world because that was the total world of people at the time. But some of these right-wing Christian nuts think the whole thing was flooded.
Yeah, they sure do. We were talking about the use of the word pleaded or pled guilty, and this was sent in, Jerry sent it in, and he said definition of pled, P-L-E-D, in English is past participle of plead.
But why do they say pleaded? I don't know. Who cares? But thank you.
I mean, I just know that my news director, when I was a television news reporter, and I did a lot of crime reporting, said that's what it was.
I was just writing a story the other day, and I put in pled, P-L-E-D, and it came up as error.
So it may be old, old English or something.
So pleaded is the word.
This All is right. Oxford.
Okay, let's, I was just there. Here is Joni. Joni is in Corktown. Lots happening in Corktown, Joni. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Happy St. Paddy's Day, Peter and Jolene.
You
well,
too.
Thank
is
you.
It still standing down there? I know the parade was a few hours back.
Well, we're getting started, so I thought I'd change the whole direction of the show. I want to tell you the joke that I won the $100 joke contest in last year.
And it's clean, right?
It's clean. Okay, if anybody can top it, I'd be happy to hear it.
Okay bring it. I'm going to write it down because I can't remember jokes.
Neither can I. So stay with me, okay?
Okay, I'm with you.
All right, two leprechauns are walking down the street in Dublin, and they're having a violent argument with each other. So one stops the other and he says, okay, Riley, we'll be settling this right now. We're going to go find the Mother Superior and ask her what she thinks. So they go find a convent. They knock on the door. They have to reach up. Mother Superior comes to the door and says, yes, can I help you? He says, Mother Superior, my friend and I are having an argument. Only you could be settling. Could you help us? She says, well, if I can, I will. He says, Mother Superior, are there any nun leprechauns here in the convent? And she says, no, I've really never heard of a nun leprechaun. So he looks at his little friend, he looks back at Mother Superior, and he says, no, Mother Superior, are there any nun leprechauns in the neighboring convent? She says, no, you know, I've never heard of a nun leprechaun in a neighboring convent either. he looks back at his little friend, finally, and he looks back at the Mother Superior, and he says, Mother Superior, are there any non-leprechauns you could be thinking of anywhere? She says, no, I've never heard of any non-leprechauns. So he looks back at his little friend, and he says, okay, Riley, I'd be telling you, that's a penguin you'll be screwing.
I love it. That's good. Yeah, you do a good Irish accent, too.
I was going to try mine with another joke. It's kind of a little off color.
Good night.
You win. All right. You win. All right. Happy St. Patty's Day.
I was just, yeah. I was. Just...
I think I can remember that one, yeah, too, Johnny.
Yeah. This one. How about this one?
We never tell jokes on this show. Right. What are we doing?
Father Sullivan is very concerned, so he's preaching to his parish in County Cork, and he says, I've heard some troubling rumors out there. He said, there are people that say they have seen a ghost. And he said, that is blasphemy. Is there anyone here who says they have seen a ghost? And O'Reilly in the back raises his hand, and Father Sullivan looks at him and gives him, you know, like, bad eye, gives him a glare.
The stink eye.
He said, worse than that, I've heard that there are people in our parish that have touched a ghost. He said, is there anybody here who has touched a ghost in our fine parish? And O'Reilly weakly raises his hand, and he says, and the most disgusting of all, that there are people that say they've had sex with a ghost. Is there anyone who is so defiled that they say they've had sex with a ghost? And again, he looks at O'Reilly, and O'Reilly puts his hand up. He says, after services, I want to see you, O'Reilly. And he says, O'Reilly, after in his study, he says, I don't know what to do. You say you've seen a ghost, you've touched a ghost, and you've even had sex with a ghost. What do you have to say for yourself? He says, oh, Father Sullivan, I thought you said a goat.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Peter, that's awful. And by the way, your Irish accent is Scottish.
I know. Yeah, I know. It is. It is.
But it was still a good Scottish Irish accent.
I know. I usually...
Peter has a sense of humor.
I usually tell it as a Scottish
accent. Don't ever deny it.
Here's Eric in Southgate. Eric, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. You are on the air. Go ahead.
Cool. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask your opinion on the top 10% paying 70% of the federal taxes.
That's sort of the right-wing talking point. You know, you're talking about this impacted wealth that these guys have. In fact, here. Well, I mean, let me just read something to you. The wealthy command so much in the world that they have trillions of dollars, you know, as opposed to the bottom, say, like $6 billion. I mean, these guys whine and cry about the fact that they are being taxed to death and all of that. But here's what Mark from Southeast Michigan wrote in. If someone had $4 billion, which is nothing, you know, less than 10% of what, like, Bill Gates had, if every day for the next 50 years that person spent over $200,000 a day, they'd still have more than they could possibly ever deal with. Bill Gates' kind of money, you could spend $2 million a day for 100 years, and he would still have $80,000 a day left over. In fact, if he gave away almost 100% of his money, he'd still be richer than what Mark says is their wildest dreams. So why do you have this kind spot in your heart for these guys that who literally make life miserable for hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people around the world?
Oh, God, no, I'm on disability, man. I just wanted to point out that the top 1% have 20% of the income, and the bottom 85% share 15% of the income. So the remaining 90% or 9% must have 50% of the other income, making 70% of the top 10%.
God, that you just made my head spin.
Yeah.
Too much math.
That did. I'm gonna think about that one. By the way, let me see. I don't have that video. But the Democrats, who are, you know, what people say, do you support? They always talk about President Obama's support is down, maybe even in the upper 30s percentage, you know. Because if you asked Jalene and I, are you satisfied with President Barack Obama, we'd say no. If that was the only, you could say yes, you could say no, I'd say no, right? Job performance, uh-uh, no good. But okay, never mind.
He hasn't done...
I was just reading something. Sorry.
Okay, well, he hasn't done... anything close to what it would have been under a McCain and, oh, my God, help us all.
Sarah Palin. Remember her?
Freaking Palin.
According to this editorial in the New York Times, they're talking about the Koch brothers, these multi-billionaires, richest two of them, have spent tens of millions of dollars peddling phony stories about the impact of health care reform, all in order to put Republicans in control of the Senate. And finally, the wimpy Democrats have started to come out front a little. You know, Senator Harry Reid, a lot of people see him as kind of wimpy and all that. But, you know, he's like a ex-boxer.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's tougher than he looks. He has been attacking the Koch brothers. They've raised $407 million in the 2012 election. And he said the billionaire Koch brothers... let me see. Where does this end here? Here, this is what Senator Mark Begich of Alaska said. They come into our town, fire a refinery, just running it into ground, leaving a mess. And it says, Mr. Reed's comments have gone to the heart of the matter. In his most recent speech, he pointed out that the fundamental purpose of the Koch brothers' spending is to rig the economic system for their benefit and for that of other oligarchs. Usually we use that phrase, the oligarchs, to mean these guys like in Russia and Eastern Europe, but we've got them here. They own an industrial network that ranks number 14 on the list of the most toxic American air polluters, and they got their money's worth in 2010 by helping elect a Republican House majority that resists environmental regulation. We don't want any government regulations, right? No, we want to be able to continue to poison people. And how psychotic can these two brothers be, these Koch brothers? They're multi-billionaires. And again, just like Mark wrote in, if you took away 99.9% of all their money, they'd still be richer than anyone listening. And probably they would probably have more money. If we took away 99.9% of their money, they'd probably have more money than everyone listening combined.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So, and I never understand people's, like, sympathy for them or concern for them. And here's what Reid said. Republican majority is working to gut the most important safeguards to keep the cancer-causing toxins and pollution that cause sickness and death out of the air we breathe and water we drink. Well, get this. The two things that they want to do is repeal Obamacare that cares for the people mm-hmm. whose toxic waste they wind up getting sick from. Without those safeguards, said Reid, the Koch brothers would pass on the higher health care costs to middle-class Americans while padding their own pocketbooks. I mean, that phrase seems crazy. Padding their own pocketbooks? I mean, they've got more money than everybody, almost.
Right.
He called it un-American to spend lavishly to preserve tax breaks for the wealthy and end workplace safety standards. Republicans quickly rushed to the cameras to demand an apology on behalf of their benefactors, furious that anyone would dare to interrupt an industrialist in the process of writing a check.
Oh, God.
Mr. Reid made it clear no apology would be forthcoming. All right, let's talk about Social Security with Mike from Jackson. Mike, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
I'm a semi-regular. Your phone guy wants you to lower your blood pressure, and my friend died of high blood pressure.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that.
Jefferson wants us to lower our blood pressure.
My blood pressure is pretty low, but go ahead.
Okay, so I reunited with my cousin. How about that guy that he's so nervous? As a consumer of Trojan condoms, GOP, these hound dogs don't play. Only Trojan condoms, deja vu. I never got in trouble in deja vu because there's no alcohol.
Oh, that's that bar, that stripper bar.
Yeah. What about the Magnums?
Yeah, because you're worried about getting in trouble too. But nobody's on trial. As a consumer of WIRF, who answered my phone call?
That's Jefferson. He's our assistant producer. And
Jefferson Aon. Jefferson Aon trial. Jefferson wants you to lower your blood pressure.
Okay.
Thank you for caring, Jefferson. We love you too.
Have fun, Peter, because I know I think first feeling economics then business, but how can we lower your blood pressure? It was Jefferson Aon trial. Jefferson wants to lower your blood pressure.
Okay, but what
Jefferson,
about
Jefferson? You're not on trial, my brother.
What about Social Security? You said you wanted to talk about Social Security. Are you with
me?
Yeah.
Yep.
I want to talk about condoms. I like that. Everyone should protect yourself.
Wrap that rascal.
Tough luck. Trojan condoms can only save your life.
But some men need a Magnum. There's a difference.
I don't know if I want to go there. All right. Listen, as a
go with the flow.
As a WRIF, what did you say, consumer or client
consumer.
Or whatever? Consumer.
Thank
I want to tell
listening.
You, and I mean this very sincerely, on behalf of the entire station, thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. All right.
Thanks, Mike.
And if you want, Mike, by the way, we'll have a podcast up of this broadcast at noon today, and you can hear this whole conversation over again that you had. All right. Bye-bye now. Here is David. David's in Detroit. David, welcome to the broadcast. I don't think I punched you up. No, here. David, hi. There you are. You're on the air. David.
Wow, that was fast. I mean, like I just called.
Well, okay.
Okay. Orson, I wanted to comment. Actually, a comment and a question for you. Comment is, I saw something really, really cool, a 13-minute video on YouTube by a journalist named Ben Swan called End of Partisanship, and it just says it all. I really think you should take the time. You'd love it. I mean, from a Democrat, Republican perspective, Libertarian, I mean, he just covers it all about the problems and the sleaze that goes on in politics and how these guys just control the whole elections, you know, the two-party system. Awesome stuff. Now, my question, what do you think, in your opinion, is worse? Somebody who has a lot of money that spends money on elections to influence the outcome, or a union that steals money from its workers to the tune of $58 million alone last year that the UAW took from its membership?
You're a UAW member,
the
right?
The first one.
You got it. I'll go with the first one. Go ahead.
The first one.
That's worse.
Yeah, right. Well, for one thing, when you belong to a union like I do, you pay membership dues. And, you know, unions are bureaucracies without a doubt, and usually the leadership that's in stays in. I mean, over the last 50 years, there's been all sorts of insurgent caucuses in any number of unions. And with a very few exceptions, like the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which actually had someone from their group that won the leadership of the presidency of the Teamsters. I don't know, was that like the 80s or something? Usually the group that's in stays in. Supposedly, though, it's a Democratic union. And Julian and I worked for the UAW. We're broadcasters for the UAW, you know, full disclosure. And within
at Solidarity House.
At Solidarity House. And particularly under Bob King, there was, you know, an intent for internal democracy. And one of the things that happened is that the unions make a decision in order to protect not only their union members, but the entire middle and working class against the ravages of the Republicans and the conservatives, that they have to spend money to get the Democrats in, as bad as they are. I mean, what do I always say? That the Democrats are better than a stick in the eye. That's the most I can say for them, with the exception of a few. Some of them are, there's a few of them out there that are fairly incredible, but not the majority of them. But the Republicans are a stick in the eye. They're a stick in the eye on the behalf of the ruling elite. And anybody who, you know, I can understand somebody that says, hey, look, I'm not going to vote for the Democrats because they're not as liberal as they say they are. They need to be more radical. There needs to be more radical reforms. But I can never understand a working class person that votes for the Republicans. So there.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't have a problem with that part of it, except when it comes to somebody like Bob King, who you could argue was solely responsible for right to work by pushing that pushing that, what was it, proposal too. If it wasn't for that, we probably wouldn't have had Right to Work.
Well, you know, I know Bob King, and I know him personally, and if he would have asked me, in fact, I said it at the time, if he would have said to me, Pete, do you think we should push this proposal too that was on the Michigan ballot in, what was it, 2012, was it? Was it in 2012 or 2010?
2012, I think.
2012. I would have said it's going to be a loser, Bill, or Bob. And sure enough, it was. So, yeah, you know, people make mistakes. I don't think any union wants to spend its money on politics and would much rather pour it into things like organizing or if it was possible to have lower dues. Because, you know, as a union, it's like, you know, structure. It's pay structure, as you probably know, for union presidents and people that work in solidarity houses is a lot better than a lot of them. I mean, they're not making $500,000, $600,000, and $700,000 or even more the way some of these Teamsters and like labor unions and all that. But my favorite union of all is the United Electrical Workers, which now was pretty much destroyed by the AFL in the late 40s and 50s, claiming it was this communist-dominated union. They have a rule that the president cannot make, the president of the union or no officer can make more than the highest paid member of their membership, which sounds good to me. So, the other thing I say, one more thing, and I'll let you have a word, which I haven't. sometimes I would say the only thing worse than a union is no union, but that's my phrase. And the unions have done so; they have saved my job. They've
helped with on a personal level. My mate, my boyfriend is a UAW member, works for General Motors, has, I don't know if he minds me talking about this. His name is David as well, by the way, David. He has diabetes. He has complications from diabetes here and there. He can't work. They take care of him every single time. And for that, I'm personally grateful.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I have no problem with that. I've been a part of them for almost 10 years out of the 15, and it's sort of bizarre because they are an auto worker union, even though I work for the casino. They do cover us. And, you know, they do have their place. I guess the only point I was trying to make was is that those folks, and I would even argue Sheldon Adelson talking about the casinos, I mean, these guys give of their money as opposed to a union that takes from other people.
They have loads of money. They should.
I was at one time.
I had loads of money, I would give too.
Yeah. Well, I was working at a station that was a union station, and I remember this guy said, who are we going to stand with? Are we going to stand with the company or our... Wait a minute.
Come on.
Are we going to stand with our company or the union? And I said, look, this company that at the time I was working for had always done well by me, but it was our union and the company. And you're expendable to any company because you're a facet of business.
Right.
And if they can get it cheaper, they get it cheaper.
If it weren't for the UAW, these many complications that my boyfriend experiences, and he were not working for the UAW, you know, a UAW member, he would have nothing. He would have no health insurance. And you know what? I'm just going to be real. He might be dead.
All right, David, I got to go to a break. Two sentences and say goodnight.
Oh, no. You know, I really don't have anything except you guys do a great job.
Thank you. I enjoy it.
And you guys have a good night.
All right, thanks, David.
Thank you very much. And we'll be right back with our final segment. And we have some open lines. So if you'd like to join us, please do. And I'm never sure. This may burst some of your bubbles, but these little things we go into are recorded. We don't have anybody in the announcer's booth.
You're not doing live interviews.
Yeah, we used to a long time ago in radio.
Well, first of all, you're interviewing people all over the world, so that's unrealistic.
No, I mean when we go to spots, the person that
Peter, it was like the 1930s when they had an announcer in the other room.
Not only that, but they had a director that would cue the announcer.
God.
I was up in a TV booth at WXYZ TV when WRF and WXYZ TV were over at Broadcast House in Southfield. And he'd be in the booth with the booth announcer, who actually was the president of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists Local, which I remember. And all of a sudden, he's getting, you know, there's a break in the show, and he knows, it shows what they call the out cue when he's supposed, and all of a sudden, this voice booms up.
I can't believe you think anyone would still think that.
Oh, no. We'll be right back. She's laughing at me, folks. She knows how to hurt a guy.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hey, this is our final segment, and we'd like you to join us on the air. 248-544-WRIF.
Wait, let me finish my cookie.
Oh, my God. You're such a professional.
248-544-9743. A girl needs a snack. You got to keep your energy level up during the show. These people are wearing me down.
You don't have to keep your energy level up. In fact, never mind.
Bring it down.
How about some chamomile tea?
Maybe a little ohm.
At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Alan Wiseman. He's written a new book on population called Countdown, sort of like the last best hope for the world. It's kind of a little frightening, except he has an amazing answer to the population program.
Oh, good.
Nothing like you'd suspect, and the opposite of any like authoritarian repression like they had in China.
Well, you and I individually have helped with population control by not having children. So
no replacements for us.
You're welcome.
And I know a lot of people think, phew.
But hey, I want to say, I've got a niece and nephew, and my niece is an awful lot like me.
There you go. And also, Andre Codrescu, the NPR commentator. You know, Andre talks like this. You know, he is You know, what other famous person is from the same area of Romania that Andre Codrescu is?
Nadia Comăneci?
No. Dracula.
Okay.
He's from Transylvania.
Oh, yes.
And Andre, an old pal, is going to be in town. Reading. In fact, the first question I ask him in this interview is, why do people, when you say poetry, they almost, head for the doors. Although people on WRIF listening to the station anytime except for when we hold forth are listening to poetry all the time.
Yeah?
The lyrics of rock and roll songs.
Oh, absolutely. That is. It is. It's poetry and song.
Right.
Poetry in motion.
Absolutely.
Thomas Dolby, remember that?
Okay, let's, I got a weird thing about my screen, but hey, go away. There you go. All right, there you go. All right, let's see. Here is Todd. Todd is in Madison Heights. Todd, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Jalene.
Hi.
Hello, Todd.
What can we do about these roads?
About the potholes?
Yeah, they're getting so bad.
I think we need to fill them with tea partiers.
I'm all for that.
I know. Wow.
I mean, that just came to me, you know.
Chamomile tea.
There's the reason I'm on the show. There's a reason I do radio.
Yeah, I was
driving down a brand new section of 75 last night, and four cars hit a pothole, and the state police were out there directing traffic.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
Well, guess what? I was thinking, like Jalene, you said that your boyfriend David had hit, what, four times?
Oh, yeah, he's had four tires, rims, all this, whole thing ruined.
I have to say,
the guy's got some serious bad luck as it begins with.
When I heard that, and I didn't say this to Jalene, and I thought, doesn't he want, look where he's going? Well, boom. I just got my car out of the shop.
Yeah, well, and he drives a lot at night.
Oh,
too.
Okay. Well, I was on the freeway, and one of the things is they consider, get this, Todd, they consider potholes to be, hitting a pothole to be an avoidable accident. In other words, driver error. And so they'll make you pay the deductible. For some reason or other, I have no idea what happened. My rear wheel hit a pothole on the freeway, and so they called it an unavoidable error and picked it up. And I couldn't believe what this cost, $700 for a wheel, $300 for a tire.
Oh, yeah.
That's insane.
It's completely
insane.
I
bought cars for less than $300.
This is why I live a very simple life,
yeah,
Peter.
For sure.
At less than $300,
so,
that was a long time ago, Peter.
It was. There used to be kind of this dumb thing that I said, why do people say that? There's two seasons in Michigan. There's winter and then there's construction. So that Todd, is what they're going to do with the potholes. You're going
to. There was something on the news the other day about some kind of pothole filler that there's some miraculous pothole filler that's on its way. I didn't watch it.
But they're.
I mean, around me, they've already put the state flower out around me.
The state flower.
Yeah. The construction barrel.
Oh. Well, you know, I mean, we have harsh winters, and this winter, we don't even need to explain that one.
No. I mean, it's quite amazing. In fact, I was seeing, you know, and it's not, I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, I was going through Pleasant Ridge, which is an upscale neighborhood.
Yeah.
And those streets were beat to hell. I mean.
You just have to be really, really careful.
Yeah. So they're going to deal with it, I guess. The state just provided a couple $100 million for filling.
I mean, what can we expect with the amount, with the record, almost record snowfall? Yeah. We're a couple inches away from that.
We could still get it. All right, Todd, thank you very much.
Bite your tongue.
Here is Ron. Ron is in Shelby Township. Ron, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter, Julie.
Hi.
Yes, Ron.
How you been?
We're good, and we're not echoing tonight, so good.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah,
what's amazing?
What's up?
CIA's not recording us this time.
Peter, I just want to hit on something that a lot of people across this country are getting to be very concerned about, okay, and you've probably heard about it, and that is smart meters.
Remind us what those are. Remind the audience.
Okay, that's for your gas, your water, and your electric. And there's a big concern about these meters because there have been houses across the country that have been catching on fire because of them, because of the electricity that they pull. Most of your older houses cannot handle the current. And also the health and safety effects as far as the RF radio frequency waves causing a lot of problems, a lot of medical problems.
This is our problem, Peter. It's the waves, man.
Well, you know what? Think about it. Let me interrupt you one second. Think about all the radio waves that are going through the air every second. I mean, when you get a phone call here, I mean,
low frequency waves.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that there is going to be a seminar, okay, this Saturday out in Canton at the Canton Library off of Canton Road. And my good friends, John and Pauline Holton, are holding the seminar. And they have been all across the state on this smart meter issue. And they have gotten 38 either moratoriums or resolutions from cities and townships. And this seminar is going to be this Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. That is 1.
What's it about? What's the
seminar?
About
the smart meters.
Is that where they drive by the house and they get your meter reading that way? Do they do that in our city, Peter?
I don't know.
No, I know for a fact they don't, because they've been bugging me to trim the bush in front of my house for about 2 years.
Well, these smart meters will actually increase your bill. Your electric bill will triple.
Triple?
They've been tripling. Their electric bills have been tripling because of these smart meters. And John and Pauline Holton have been on numerous radio programs across the country, including Coast to Coast and Joyce Riley.
Hey, do this. Do you use the Internet? You do, like, email?
No, I don't. But
okay.
I myself, okay, Peter, Julie, you don't know this, but I happen to be very well known out here in Shelby Township. Okay?
Really?
I bet you are.
And I am all up on the smart meter also, and also Agenda 21. And I do public speaking myself. Okay,
if you're not on the internet, where do you get your kind of current information that you bring to us every week? Where do you get that?
Well, I have many people that John and Pauline Holton.
I know that they're full of information. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I do research, And
do you go to the library? Do you read newspapers?
Yeah, go to the library and that. Yeah.
Boy, that's old school. But I mean, I appreciate that. Hey, listen, I actually do have to move on. But would you ask one of these people that do use
John or Pauline Holton?
Yeah, to email me. They can let me know, and not 100% sure about all the all the information about these smart meters, and tell them to send, if you can remember, it's just calltalkyes@yahoo.com. They'll remember it. All right, thanks for all the information, Ron. All right, bye. All right. they were talking about if you legalize marijuana, how it would help with taxes. The Colorado Department of Revenue.
Unreal what it's done in Colorado.
$2 million in marijuana taxes in January. And expected to grow as more retailers are licensed. And they had a job fair on Thursday for people that wanted to work in the industry.
There was a job fair here. Not a job fair. There's a marijuana fair coming here somewhere.
Oh, I have a T-shirt for that, but as long ago as 2008, a medical marijuana T-shirt.
Yeah, there's one coming. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Anyway, so they have something called Hemp Temps. A specialist staffing agency and medicine man at a dispensary were also hunting for candidates. Job descriptions included bud tender, sales representative, and web designer. All right. They had 600 job seekers. Let's see.
So it's creating jobs.
Yeah.
Tax revenues.
I wonder what that means. I mean, you always had to be.
Isn't this what we've always said, Peter?
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, too, I thought there's this whole thing now about everybody's talking, including these Republicans, at least these more libertarian guys like Senator Rand Paul, that they want to start reducing these nonviolent marijuana and drug, not just marijuana, but drug offenders that are in the federal system.
Yeah, filling the prisons.
Well, it's working so badly. You know, and people forget. I mean, you have this real punitive spirit. I don't think people are really punitive about drug use anymore the way they were. But, $1 trillion later, it's still, the drugs are still flowing.
They're still coming on in.
But here in another one of these issues about capital punishment, in New Hampshire, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly 225-104 to repeal the death penalty. Then it's going to go to the state Senate, and the governor, Maggie Hassan, said she would sign it. If New Hampshire abolishes the death penalty, become the 19th state to do so. No state has abolished it since the 1960s, but six states, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, have abolished it just in the last 6 years well.
I was surprised at what year was it of Michigan? It was early on that Michigan did
The state
it.
Of Michigan has never had a death penalty.
I thought that they made a law.
In the Constitution.
Sort of law about it way, way back when.
The Michigan Constitution, 1835, said no capital punishment.
That's what it is, yeah.
It's something really to be proud of. And guess what? The crime rate, the murder rate. We're sort of right in the middle for a state like ours, or for like a state anywhere. New Hampshire is the last state in New England to have the death penalty. It has the death penalty. It hasn't executed anybody, and this is correct date, 1939.
Hey, how about that?
Right. And here's the deal. There's one guy on death row in New Hampshire who killed a police officer, and the guy's partner, John Breckinridge, it happened in 2006, His partner was shot to death in an alley, and he said he just longed for the death penalty. It was revenge for his partner's death. Mm. Understandable. He's changed it. He says that he renewed his Roman Catholic faith, and he said he's emerging on the other side of the debate. He says, for me, this has been all about anger, and I realized my anger was about vengeance, not about justice. And some people said, hey, where is it in here? Somebody in here said they'd rather have them in there thinking about in prison for the rest of their life, thinking about what they did and what they took.
I'd say that's a much more harsh punishment.
I don't know.
For the person. If you have to sit in there,
that was pretty bad. You don't get to reflect on
it. It's not a fun place on any level.
And a Republican who supports the death penalty in New Hampshire said, this is not Texas. We're not executing prisoners every week. Well, I guess not. They haven't done it since 1939.
Yes.
But here's the deal. The one person on death row, this Addison, was sentenced to death in 2008 for the 2006 murder of Officer Briggs. His case is expected to cost at least $8 million as he appeals. And the annual cost for someone in prison for life is $35,000. So, 10, 320, 320. No
math on the air. But what we do know is that it costs way more money to execute someone than to keep them in there forever.
You know what is interesting? This Representative Steve Velicord, who's a Republican, said if you want to abolish the death penalty, you have to abolish it for Michael Addison as well, the killer of the police officer. Because there was this argument about whether to have it retroactive or not. It would, you know, essentially be this one guy. Says Mr. Velicord, a Republican whose father was murdered, but he sponsored the amendment to that would be retroactive, so that the guy that killed the cop would get off. And then it says another of those leading the fight for a repeal was Representative Robert Cushing, a Democrat whose father was murdered in 1988. What's happening up there in New Hampshire?
You tell me.
Isn't that odd?
It sure is.
That you had, I wonder how many other people, like in the Michigan State Legislature, or just in the House, how many state House members have had somebody in their family murdered?
Right, that's true.
Yeah, like that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
All I know is your headphones are squealing.
I can't even, there you go.
God, I hate that.
What else?
Well, you know what? I think that's a wrap.
Should we wrap it?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, it's been a what?
It's been another interesting night call show.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad to be back. I had last week off for my birthday. I toasted you all with a couple of cocktails.
You know, my wife said, how did Jalene's birthday go? Because I knew that her boyfriend was planning this real gala blowout, and I said, I forgot to ask her.
We talked about it. You forgot that we talked about it.
I'll ask you after the show. All right. Stay tuned. Got a couple of great interviews. But in the meantime, you can check my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And also our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. And the whole story of the St. Patrick's Battalion.
This group, so interesting.
This group of, talk about on St. Patrick's Day, this Irish battalion of U.S. Army deserters who deserted and fought with the Mexican Army against the U.S. Army in Mexico. It's quite a story.
Fought on the Mexican side, DavidRovix.com.
I wish you would sing more.
I wish I would, too.
Yeah. I have a singer-songwriter sitting right here, and you haven't been performing publicly lately?
I haven't in a couple of years. I have been writing.
Have you? That's
I
good.
Have been writing. I always write. You know,
okay. So. All right, Jefferson, thank you so much. And,
yes, thanks,
hey,
Jefferson.
In the meantime, if you want to make any further comments online, you can either do it at our Facebook page, or you can do it at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we're going to begin with a little interview about population and what we're facing. And
thank you for all your calls.
Oh, yeah. This is from Alan Weissman.
Don't drink and drive.
Who was on the Bill Maher show. So listen up, and we'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Discover the difference between memorable and unforgettable with a Cobalt boat from Action Water Sports of Fenton. Cobalt makes boat after boat so perfectly suited to its owners that, once aboard, there's no place in the world they'd rather be. Reward yourself for your hard work and accomplishments by spending quality time with family and friends on the water in a Cobalt boat from Action Water Sports of Fenton. Experience the enjoyment realized from little details derived from nearly 50 years of Cobalt classic tradition, like superior ride, flip down swim step, hydraulic swim platforms, flip up seat bolsters, multi-position seat backs, the safety of deep bow seating, and overall comfort and luxury. Action Water Sports also has the largest pro shop in the area for anything you could want to use with your boat, from gear to lifestyle clothing. If you're looking for a premium day boat, you must look at Cobalt Boats from Action Water Sports of Fenton, located at 8051 Old US 23, just south of Exit 75 off of US 23. Get more details at actionwater.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now for your entertainment, what we've all been waiting for. The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich published a book called The Population Bomb. So we just had too many people on the planet, and probably most of you folks think, yeah, there's a lot of folks. Maybe not here in the Detroit area. The city proper is actually being rather depopulated. But there is tremendous population growth, and we usually think of it as something that's occurring in what we call third world countries, and we always sort of tisk about that, whereas we go along our merry way in our daily life here in the northern tier countries. No problem, right? Well, maybe that isn't the case, unfortunately. It's a brand new book called Countdown, and get this subtitle, folks, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's a question mark. For a future on Earth, could population threaten our existence on the planet that much? Alan Weisman is the author of this, and he is an American author, a professor, and a journalist. And he published not so long ago the national bestseller called The World Without Us. And I want to hook this up with that one. He's the author of several books, including the one I just mentioned, which is an international bestseller, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And he's an award-winning journalist. His reports have appeared in Harper's, the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Discover, Vanity Fair, and quite a few others. He lives in western Massachusetts, where it probably is snowing, but he's right now we're reaching him at a book fair that he's going to be appearing at in the desert outside of Tucson, Arizona. We're envious, Alan. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, so Paul Ehrlich, long time ago, I can't even do the math hardly, way back in the day, 1968, said too many folks, there was a population bomb. And a lot of people said, no, you know, this is actually anti-third world and anti-minority, and everything will take care of itself. The rate will slow, we'll be able to get more food for folks. How's it all turned out in your estimation and what you chronicle in Countdown?
Well, the rate has slowed, but only slightly. There are now more than twice as many people on the planet than there were when Paul Ehrlich wrote that book. And we're starting to really feel the pain of living on a planet that is completely stressed out by the demands that one species puts on it. Now, before anybody gets very upset with me and thinks that I am some kind of misanthrope that hates the human race, particularly since I wrote a book called The World Without Us.
Yeah.
I wrote that book because I wanted a world with us. The whole idea of that one was to theoretically remove us from the planet, show how when relieved of our daily pressures that nature can heal rather quickly, restore even niches that we've inadvertently emptied, and really make this a beautiful place again with surprising swiftness. And I wanted people to think, wow, is there some way, though, that we could add ourselves back to that picture of a newly healed Earth, only in harmony with nature and not in constant combat with it? But I had planned to talk about how we would do that in the epilogue. However, I ran into this rather uncomfortable fact. You see these numbers about population, and they're meaningless to us because they're just too big for us to wrap our minds around. But thanks to the invention of the calculator, even I can do long division. And dividing up some of these numbers by the number of days, I realized that every 4 to 4.5 days, we add 1 million people to the planet. And that is still going on, and that's not slowing down anytime soon. So the idea of population finally slowing down and stabilizing, it's sort of like one of my sources in this book says, it's kind of like firemen going to put out a house fire and say, oh, you know, we don't have to do anything. It'll put it, you know, eventually put itself out. Population is way, way out of balance with the rest of the planet for reasons that we can talk about. And we're probably going to have to do something about that, or it's going to happen to us, and that's not going to be a very pretty sight.
Well, I've heard it said that this is going to happen, that catastrophes because of population are going to occur. The only way we can really intervene effectively is to try to mitigate the worst parts of it. Or can it just be, I mean, I know it can't be magically done, and policies and culture and ways of living have to be altered. Is catastrophe really on the agenda? Because what happens, of course, is that people say, oh, Alan Weisman, you are just Chicken Little. You know, you're Cassandra. The sky is not falling, and technology will find a way to fix this.
Well, I addressed every one of those questions in this book, Countdown, which I wrote Growing Out of the World Without Us, because I wanted to look to see, is there something that we can do before nature in a calamitous way does it to us? And particularly, is there something that we can do that people don't find abhorrent and unacceptable? Because when you think about the idea of managing our population, people don't think manage. They think control, and they think China and its one-child policy, sure, which nobody likes, including the Chinese. So I ended up traveling to 21 different countries for this book. I started in Israel and Palestine. I ended in Iran. And I was looking all over the world for examples of places that have dealt with this issue, but dealt with it in a non-coercive and even voluntary way. I was surprised to find quite a few of them, because when I say that the growth rate is going down, it means that almost half the countries in the world are dealing with this situation right now. But there are some notable exceptions, and frankly, you and I are sitting in one of them. There are ways that we can bring population down by letting people make that decision for themselves as to how many children that they want. It just becomes very attractive to them to have smaller families. And it turns out to be one of the cheapest things that we can do that would have a very helpful effect on mitigating the environmental damage that so many of us are doing. So I can start in there anywhere and tell you how we bring it about, or maybe it would be helpful for us to talk about how did we get to be this populous in the first place.
Let's do that. Alan Weisman is my guest. He is the author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, and it's a question mark. It's published by Little Brown. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, as well. I was thinking of a bumper sticker I once saw, and you sort of mentioned it in a different way, and the bumper sticker said, "Nature bats last," which is pretty ominous. And so we're in the ninth inning, so we better put some runs in there to make sure that this all doesn't occur. Well, let me. I certainly want to talk about what you just mentioned, but let me throw this into it, and that is that high birth rates in large families are usually associated with poverty areas, that is what we call underdeveloped countries, third world countries. And the idea that if these countries no longer were poor, they could actually start consuming more. They would start living a life like we do here, say, in St. Clair Shores, a suburb of Detroit. So it seems to be a conundrum. Either way you cut it, it's either more people or higher consumption. It kind of scares me.
Well, these are big problems, and they all lead back to the fact that there are just an awful lot of us right now. Now, until about 1800, this problem really didn't exist on the planet. We weren't in the ninth inning. We were just sort of standing there on home plate. We were basically in balance with the rest of the planet because, like every other species, unfortunately, we had high infant mortality rates. Most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday. And you can imagine the pain of our ancestors. But this is why nature has designed us and every other organism to make copies of ourselves and actually make a lot of extra copies of ourselves, knowing that most of them aren't going to survive. But just before 1800, a vaccination for smallpox was invented. And in the next century, that led to more vaccines and to the discovery of antiseptics, of hygiene in hospitals and everywhere else, pasteurization of milk, this just barrage of medical improvements. And, hey, I'm not against them. Nobody is against them because, not only did all those babies die, but life expectancy was 40 back then. So most of us who are over that age wouldn't even be around. But this pushed our numbers beyond a billion. And by 1900, we were at just above a billion and a half. And then in the 20th century, something much bigger than medical technology happened. We learned first how to pull nitrogen out of the air and chemically spread it on soil. It used to be that the amount of plant life on the planet was limited to the nitrogen contribution of a relatively few plants that host this bacteria that can fix nitrogen into the soil. But now we can do it chemically. And to give you an idea of how important, I think that's the most important invention in the history of the world, because 40% of us would not be here if nitrogen fertilizer had not been invented. Of course, now we know all of its downsides. It's a huge source of greenhouse gases, both in its fabrication and when it decays, and it goes downstream and it follows our rivers and leaves chunks the size of New Jersey dead in the ocean. But nevertheless, that's what happened. And then, since you mentioned technology solving all these problems, when the Ehrlichs, and I say Ehrlichs because Paul's wife, Anne, was the unacknowledged co-author of that book. His publisher didn't want two names on there for some reason. When they wrote their book, in the preface, they said that we are going to have widespread famines in all over Asia during the 1970s because of population growth unless an agricultural miracle took place. And unbeknownst to them, it was already in the works. We call it today the Green Revolution. Sure. Plants were developed that could grow much more grain per stalk of rice or wheat, etc. And India and Pakistan, the first places it was tried out, were saved. And the famine never occurred, and many people said that the Ehrlichs and that Malthus before them were completely debunked. You know, they always predicted that the food supply or population would outrace the food supply. But the founder of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, is credited with saving more lives than anybody in history. He did not disagree with them. He was on the boards of population groups because he knew the paradox of food is that if more people don't die of famine, they live to beget more people and more people. So today, India is about to surpass China this coming decade as the most populous nation on Earth. And Pakistan is one of the fastest growing. And I went to both countries when I was researching Countdown. And Pakistan, to give you an example here, this is an important one. Because in 1958, Dwight D. Eisenhower appointed a general to study overpopulation, and he said it is going to be the biggest global security issue in the post-war era. Pakistan right now has nearly 200 million people in a country that's the size of Texas, which only has 26 million. Its economy can't afford to employ them, so it's got all these angry, frustrated young men, and you know what they turn into. By the middle of the century, it will have nearly 400 million people. That's way more than the United States has today. It'll still be the size of Texas. And the country's just out of control. It was mayhem every day that I was there. There were shootings. There was gang warfare in the streets of the cities. And I was in Karachi, considered a safer city. And this is a nuclear power. So this is a serious issue, even beyond the environmental reasons that we're going to talk about, just for security reasons.
Yeah. You know, Mike Davis, I'm sure you're familiar with his book, Planet of Slums, which now the majority of people live in cities. And I know in your book, Countdown, you mentioned that there were, I forgot how many, 150 Chinese cities with more than a million people, and by 2025, there'll be 220.
Just amazing.
Mike Davis lists a number of these cities throughout the southern tier of the world, what we call. And over 5 million, like what do we have, 3 cities in the United States with over population of over 5 million? And he was naming all of these. I hadn't heard of three-quarters of them. So people are streaming into the city, so there's not the people aren't producing for themselves. They're expecting to be able to purchase food and everything else as commodities. So that's certainly a difficulty.
And it's not just food, but you have to realize that every person uses energy. We're all addicted to energy. We were born into the addiction to electricity. And, of course, they need shelter. You know, just the food supply alone. In the Green Revolution centers I visited for this book, because in the Vatican they said this is how we're going to solve population. We don't have to solve it because they're coming up with new transgenic food that will increase yields even more. But the people in the Green Revolution centers, the scientists said, look, you know, already 40% of the world is devoted to feeding just one species. To feed everybody else the way population is growing, by the middle of the century, we're going to have to produce more food than has been produced in the history of humankind. And the transgenic things they're trying to do are decades away, even if they can do them. But the energy thing, look, we all know it's pretty, you know, there's a 99.9% scientific consensus on this, that to have our jet-propelled civilization, we burn fossil fuel. That's 80% of our energy, and we're not going to replace it overnight. And even if we did, it would take decades for the construction of those plants, you know, the energy cost to be amortized before it was really zero emissions. We're pushing more carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere right now than there has been in 3 million years. And 3 million years ago, the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. The same thing 15 million years ago, the last time there was this much CO2 in the air. So if we can't slake this addiction any other way, the one thing that we can do is start to bring into control the number of emitters of all of this energy. And fortunately, this is something that we can do. I can give you one example.
Well, let me interrupt you just one second, because I was going to say, you know, this is beginning this is a warning. You know, when you get warned, everything in the world isn't supposed to make you happy. And I can't imagine my conversation with Alan Weisman about his brand new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And it's a question mark here as well, has done anything other than people going, ooh. So, but your book does contain all the travels you did investigating for this book around the world to different countries, does provide some hope, right?
I came out of this book more hopeful than I went into it, because I saw so many examples that were so different, because each one was specific to a different kind of culture and acceptable to that culture. And also, I found out how cheap it would be. Let me give you one of those examples.
Sure.
There's one that'll surprise everybody. It's because it's right out of what has been called in this country the Axis of Evil. In 1979, Iran had its Islamic Revolution. Right after that, Saddam Hussein attacked them. You know, he wanted to see this oil-rich province on their border. He figured it was, you know, they were just getting organized. It would be easy pickings. And he had the backing of NATO then. He had sophisticated weaponry. All Iran had was people. And the Ayatollah asked every fertile Iranian woman to do her patriotic duty and help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders. And they managed to hold them to a truce for 8 years. But after that, an economist who was head of planning and budget for Iran realized that all these kids were going to grow up, and within 10 years, they were going to have the same problem Pakistan has today with all these unemployed young men. So he convinced the Ayatollah that they had to start family planning. And this was right the transition to the present Ayatollah today. He issued a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates you've got the number of children that you can responsibly take care of, that you can't use any form of birth control from condoms all the way up to operations. Next, they made all that available all over the country. I interviewed this devout Muslim woman, an OBGYN in Tehran, and she told me they would go on horseback to all these little villages and later by four-wheel drive and made sure that everybody could have the number of children they wanted, but they had access to make that decision because they could get birth control. The only thing that was obligatory was premarital counseling for each new couple, which, frankly, is not a bad idea for any of us. And in those classes, among other things, they talked about how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, educate a child. And fourth, and this is really important, they encouraged girls to stay in school. Everywhere I went for this book, rich country, poor country, a girl in school will defer her childbearing until she's out of school. And then she's got something interesting and useful and helpful to her family's economy to do with it. But you can't do that with seven kids hanging on you. So overwhelmingly, on the average, everywhere, a girl who gets through high school is probably going to have two kids or fewer. And two kids, you know, that takes two people to make a kid. So that's really replacing themselves. So there's no population growth with two. And if people choose to have fewer, then population comes down. If we just educated women all over the world, we would not have a population problem. Within the next two generations, we would come back down towards a sustainable size.
Alan Weisman, speak to this a little. A lot of times, the critics of Malthus and Paul Ehrlich, and maybe you've faced this yourself, say this is about the white northern tier countries wanting less poor people, less people of color. So, I mean, you mentioned Iran, but because here, gee, we're not overcrowded in the U.S., are we? Look at Detroit. I mean, we're even trying to downscale our city. There's so few people here. How does that work out in terms of, like, the Netherlands? People are packed in there per square mile, except we don't see them as a problem. Or do we?
Well, you know, Detroit is an anomaly in the United States, and you guys know the historic reasons for that, you know, far better than I do. The United States is still growing. We're the third biggest country on earth population-wise, and it's because of immigration that, fortunately, as I found all over Europe, and you mentioned the Netherlands, you know, there are these, you know, these hate rumors that you hear all over about how all of Europe is turning into a Muslim country because these people come up with these huge families and then, you know, they have more huge families. Well, they're not doing that. Just like Mexican girls come into the United States, they get into the school system, and maybe they were from a big family, you know, back in Bangladesh or Latin America, but here they tend to have two children or fewer. But it's going to take a couple of generations for this all to die down. Mexico is very close to replacement rate. They've had a very good voluntary program there, and was based around soap operas, which everybody likes to watch. They just had some series of soap operas that just sort of gave the message that smaller families seem to do a lot better than big families.
Alan Weisman, there's just a couple minutes left. What about policy? What should we do here in the U.S.? Does it take laws, statutes? I mean, we don't want to wind up like China, as you said.
No.
China doesn't want to do that. What do we do here in the States?
What it takes everywhere in the world, and it starts here in the United States, is making sure that funding is available so everybody has access to birth control, to choose to use it if they want to use it. To do that worldwide would cost about $8.1 billion a year, which is less than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan during most of the past decade. That's chicken feed. I'm proud to say that the United States, through USAID, is the biggest provider of contraception in the world, but we just have to do better because there's a quarter of a billion women who don't have it. There are soap operas now that are being played in Los Angeles, targeted to these immigrant teenagers who are coming in that are becoming extremely effective. So we just give people the opportunity to make the decision for themselves. And anybody who thinks that, you know, that this is a veiled anti-abortion program, you know, if contraception were universally available, the 40 million abortions every year would drop down to 14 million. And that's the best anti-abortion program I know, saving us from 36 million abortions, because half of all pregnancies in the United States and in the world are unintended. And that's a very sad thing.
Yeah, those same forces that are anti-choice often are also anti-contraception. I think if you tried to have government policy around availability, say like free universal availability of birth control, you would run into a bad storm of sorts.
You know, it's a few people who speak really in shrill voices. You know, let those politicians explain that one to their wives. You know, one of the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the United States is in some of those states, you know, where there are a lot of, you know, shrill anti-contraception, frankly, men who are declaring a war on women. In Catholicism, we all know the position of the Vatican. I went there for countdown. But 98% of Catholic women in the United States have used or are currently using contraception. Italy has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world because it has one of the highest rates of female education, even though it surrounds the Vatican. So let the people decide for themselves, not the politicians and not some church leader who has, you know, who has to scream from the pulpit and make people feel guilty.
Well, we are out of time with Alan Wiseman, and what a good and eloquent warning, but also some hope in the subtitle. The book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And there's a question mark in it, but I would put it as an exclamation point. And there'll be a link to Alan Wiseman's book on my website, PeterWerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Rib. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. The new age of water skiing has arrived. See the new Mastercraft Pro Star at Action Water Sports of Fenton. Seasoned water skiers know Mastercraft is the benchmark, and those who insist on quality look no further. Nobody builds a boat like Mastercraft, and nobody offers the same superior customer service as Action Water Sports of Fenton. The new 2014 Mastercraft Pro Star exhibits technology and engineering marvels. Side spray and the ski wake have been reduced to nearly non-existent. Experience unparalleled sight lines over a low-profile dash and a super bright touchscreen with easy-to-use controls. The twin-tip bow offers a convertible top to allow for open or closed bow boating. Action Watersports also has the largest pro shop in the area for anything you could want to use with your boat, from gear to lifestyle clothing. If you're ready to up your ski performance, you must look at Mastercraft Boats from Action Watersports of Fenton, located at 8051 Old US 23, just south of Exit 75 off of US 23 in Fenton. Get more details at actionwater.com.
Partnerships can be a wonderful thing. Together, people can achieve things they never could alone. But sometimes good partnerships go bad. When that happens, people together achieve less than they could alone, or so they believe. Marriage is like that. But it's also much more than that. On the one hand, marriage is by far the most important partnership anyone will ever join. Everything people own or care about, even kids, become a sort of partnership property. On the other hand, marriage is also a lifetime commitment, for better or for worse. That makes marriage a unique partnership. Personal success is less important than partnership success. Unfortunately, the marital partnership is a fragile one. Only one partner's vote is necessary to destroy it. Hello, I'm Joe Cordell of Cordell & Cordell. Our firm represents men whose partners have cast that vote.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor. 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. You know, the worst thing you can absolutely do in radio is sort of begin with an apology. But among some people, poetry is, people go, oh, poetry. Most of you listen to poetry every day, right? It's something like, except it's got music in back. Oh, baby, oh, I love you so, and all of that. But poetry is a dynamic form of communication, and I don't know where it's gotten sort of a name as being stuffy and boring and academic and what have you. And my guest, Andrei Codrescu, probably remember, since I've had him on the show any number of times, and I always start the show like this. Andrei Codrescu is probably best known as a commentator on National Public Radio, NPR, but he's also a poet, a novelist, an essayist. He's done screenwriting and so many other things, and he's coming to Detroit. For so many years, after living in Detroit for a while in the 1960s, moving to New York, finally spending a lot of time in the New Orleans area, in fact, being a professor of English, a distinguished professor of English, I should add, at Louisiana State University from 1984 until he retired a couple of years ago, has now moved, and this, I gotta talk to him about this, he now lives in the Ozarks near the Buffalo River National Park. Andrei Codrescu, as always, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
Now, you were born in Romania, actually in Transylvania, with another famous guy whose name I forget right now. But so it's a long way from Transylvania to the Ozarks and through Detroit and New York and New Orleans, Baton Rouge. It's quite an odyssey.
Well, it's a long way from Transylvania anywhere, especially to Detroit. And it's an anniversary of sorts, because I got to Detroit in March. It's about the same time in 1966. And it was a miserable day with chill, with sleet. And this after being in Rome, which was full of color and heat and people on the streets. And so I got to Detroit, and it was cold and miserable, and I had a little in nylon jackets, and I kept watching Cars, and I kept thinking, where are the people? And now I'm coming back to see how the people are living. Actually, I've been back many times.
Sure you have. And Andre Andre Codrescu is going to be part of the Woodward Line Poetry Series, and he's going to be appearing at the Scarab Club. That's right in back of the Detroit Institute of Arts on Wednesday, March 19th. It's free. 7 o'clock, and Andre has written dozens of books. One so recently, Rent a World, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 2012. One of my favorite titles, The Post-Human Dada Guide, Tsara and Lenin Play Chess, Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. People like you, Andre, I think I always say I can barely keep my shoes tied, and yet you're putting these books out that are everything from, well, they all are. They're both thoughtful and they're entertaining. Yeah, go start with my apology and my apologies for apologizing for poetry. And why do you think that it has the reputation that it does as academic and boring and stuffy? Well, that means people haven't heard you and so many other folks. Where did it get its, quote, bad reputation from among the, quote, common people?
Well, it got a bad reputation from school because bad teachers who don't understand poetry and bad poets who pretend to be teachers have bored generations of students with what they mistake for poetry. And not just because, it may actually be poetry that they bore them with, but the way they deliver it and misunderstand it is deadly. And so I think part of it has to do with school. Part of it has to do with the fact that poetry is really subversive, and it's an old currency. It's, forget Bitcoin and all this newfangled stuff. The oldest currency in the world is poetry. People, when they had time from hunting and chopping down wood for houses, they sat around the fire and they told each other stories, and to remember them, they told them in verse. And so it's the oldest form of human bonding and currency. It's a form that people trusted from the beginning, and it's going to be that again in the future. Forget your paper dollars. Poetry is the money.
I don't know whether your poetry, all of your writing has such an original flavor to it, and yet the line that you said, and you may know that, Stéphane, is it Mallarmé, the French poet? He actually said those words that you did. The poetry is subversive, but why? Why did he say that? Why did you? So let me put it right out there. Did you steal that line, or is it just great minds working along the same path?
Oh, I think it's just something that poets know, because they also know that language mostly lies.
Ah.
People use language to lie to each other and and to cheat each other and to incite each other to murder. And so within this language that we destroy constantly through advertising and political speech and all kinds of appeals to emotion, there is another language that's the secret language of poetry, which has this rare quality of telling a truth that's really mysterious. And people intuit that. I don't think, you can explain it better than you can in the poem itself. But, this is, you read through language. And, the The language gets killed every day on television, by advertisements. It gets killed by bad shows where people say platitudes and things that just aren't true. You know, people lie about relationships. They lie about how they feel. You know, ask anybody how they feel, and they're not going to give you a quote from Blake, energy is eternal delight. They will say, I feel fine, even though, you know, they just lost their love and their hand.
Mm-hmm.
In their hair.
Right. Andre Codrescu is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's going to be here in Detroit. I'll have a link to all the details about his appearance, and he's with a couple of other poets as well, Leanne Brown and Kathy Bohintz. Free admission at the Scarab Club on Wednesday, March 19th. Doors open at 7 o'clock. It's this Woodward Line Poetry Series at the Scarab Club, and it's the third Wednesday, September through June, so it's been going on. It's to this June. Andre, you didn't really answer, though, about you Transylvania, Detroit, New York, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and now you are ensconced in the Ozarks, near the Buffalo River National Park. I always thought of you as a big city boy, and here you are out in the country.
Well, I was for the longest time. I mean, when I was younger, I was a mobile unit. I like cities, and I move through them and like a kind of wilderness. But right now, it seems that whatever was interesting about cities, and this Detroit is an exception to this, actually, but whatever was interesting about them, the cities I lived in was the fact that they had wild areas, that they had this sort of edge of dangers in neighborhoods that are just unpredictable, and it was fun, it was adventurous. But, you know, they've all gotten pretty predictable, and, you know, urban planning has gotten rid of most people you can't Google. And so, you know, I always wanted to be a kind of a monk, and so now I'm in the woods, and I have a wood shop and a workshop and lots of places to roam, and it's one of the few places you can be outside a lot. Because
mm-hmm.
you can't be outside anywhere, so the inside is kind of taking over everything. People are either inside their apartment or inside their computer or inside their job, but it's very hard to be outside at all. It's not about work. It's just about the outside.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the inside is just a place of control, you know, that's all. And the outside still has some kind of... you know, probability of improbability.
You know, it's interesting that you said in passing that you have a wood shop. So many of the Detroit-based artists and poets are also work with their hands. I mean, it would take too long to name all of them. Is there any connection? I mean, one would think, again, that goes back to the stereotype of poets and poetry, that they're effete. Not that, as we say these days, not that there's anything wrong with that, but that, you know, that probably most poets and artists wouldn't even know which end of a hammer to use. Yet I would say, and in you and I know many of the same, in fact, probably all of the same Detroit poets and artists, many of them who have gone on to quite a bit of prominence, also do quite a bit of work with their hands. Is there any connection, or is this just a Detroit coincidence?
Well, no, there are several connections. I think one of them is that the Ozarks are sort of oriented toward the Midwest, and the Midwest is a practical place. It's where people like to tinker in the workshop and see how things fit together and work with tools. That's one thing. But the other is the stereotype of the poet or the, you know, scholar as a kind of an idiot, an impractical idiot, which is not, you know, the case with most people I know. I mean, I just wanted to learn how to, you know, use tools and make things, and I just never had the space in the city to do it, you know. But now I'm just, you know, sort of a fanatic of the right sandpaper.
Yeah, one, you find out, it's measured in numbers, right? I was actually working under someone's tutelage, and I was thinking, some of this really fine stuff, what does it go up to? Into the 300s, doesn't it? How fine it is, and when you're finally getting down to that final part, and it almost doesn't sand. It's almost, you go, wait a minute, is this sandpaper? But that's maybe another subject.
Oh, no, it's not, actually, because it's all about measuring, you know. I mean, really, you know, to measure correctly anything is just an extraordinary thing. I mean, I'm just, you know, learning of what a 1/16 of an inch is. And, you know, I sort of know that intuitively when I write a poem, you know, because you kind of count, the syllables are just scanned in your brain, you know, but to actually see that same process in the world of hard materials and things is really there's a great joy in it. It's almost like, you know, you start thinking again, which very few people do anymore.
When I introduced you and was talking about how many different cities that you were in and how each of them was so instrumental in place and what came out of there in terms of your poetry, your novels, screenwriting, all of this. So here you met John Sinclair in Detroit in the artist workshop. New York was Allen Ginsberg, Ted Berrigan, and Waldman. A lot in New Orleans, and now you're out in the woods. Is it okay? Or I mean, to not have that. I mean, I guess you said it was. We were talking earlier about this, to have this intense interaction with people whose brains are always at 120%. I mean, I suppose mine is as well, because once your intellect gets rolling, that inertia is gone, and you're not just a receptor. You're going. So I guess I'm interested, because I just feel so jammed with so many things about solitude. Do you have solitude now out there near the Buffalo River National Park?
Well, it's a paradox, because I have solitude, but I'm doing more than I ever have. You know, I move more than I ever have, so I do lots of things. I just, you know, do more than I did when I lived in the cities. But all those poets that you mentioned actually were very eminently practical people, in the sense that they wanted to do things. They wanted their poetry to do things, for one thing. They wanted to be with people. They wanted to test the effect of word in a social milieu, or if not, you know, be working undisturbed. So all of those poets, you know, I'm thinking of Allen Ginsberg, for instance, was really famous, you know, almost like a pop star. You know, probably was a pop star in his day in some way. And Alan was always interested in them. He was also a photographer, and he was interested in the details and the aesthetics and the tools, you know, of how you live in the world. And so, yeah, Detroit was great for me, because, I mean, John Sinclair's place was called The Workshop. You know, the Detroit writers and music workshop, you know. So he went there to work, you know, to make works anyway that were useful in some way and interesting to you. And then I had the pleasure of meeting John again in New Orleans, which was my other big city. But John, you know, has been a part of my life, just like Detroit has, because of its work ethic and the fact that people do things, you know, and they do things so that, you know, they mean something.
Mm-hmm. Andre Codrescu is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's going to be appearing in Detroit this Wednesday, March 19th, at the Woodward Line Poetry Series at the Scarab Club in Detroit, right in the back, right in the, on John R., right in the back area behind the Detroit Institute of Arts. It's free. It's part of an ongoing poetry series that goes the third Wednesday through June. You came from Romania. And, you know, actually, I should remember, we've talked so many times, is it with a U or with an O? Is it Romania or Romania? Romania.
Well, it's just an O, but the old spellings are the U, but I think they gave that up. I have no idea why. Okay. There is probably some giant linguistic political battle behind that vowel, but I don't remember it.
Well, you get one people don't that I don't think a lot of people know is that the Romanian language is a Romance language with a connection with Italian and Spanish and something else, right? A Portuguese. Yeah. So, you know, I was looking back at how many times I've interviewed you, and it's kind of scary, you know, the way the years go by. But I remember when you you covered the Romanian Revolution of 1989, and you went back there, and were not quite as impressed with the results as other people were. The horrible dictator was taken down. That was a good thing. Well, the book was what? The Hole in the Flag. Wasn't that the name of it?
That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, hey. My,
yeah,
I have something of a memory. You know. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, it's, but, you know, that I was very happy to see, in 1989 to see that, you know, the dictator was gone. And so revolution, I put the revolution on the cover of my book without quotation marks. But then as time kept going by and we kept finding out more things about how those things really went down, the quotation marks appeared around the word revolution. And right now I would say that there are about four sets of quotation marks around there, and that the so-called revolution was really a coup d'etat by the people who assassinated the Ceausescu couple, their own inner power circle, who ended up dividing the corpse of the states when they were dead. And their children, and they ruled the country now just like they do in all the ex-Soviet fiefdom, you know, and in Russia and in all the other countries. And actually what's happening in Ukraine now is really a classic form of revolution, just like the one in Romania.
Yeah, it's, I was going to say, it's interesting, at the time when the Soviet states began to shed their ostensibly socialist or communist governments, we thought that the way was open, that they actually could have had a democratic, what they call social democratic government, because most of the major means of production were owned by the state, and state could keep doing it, except not on a, as a racket and not corrupt and not with a dictatorial police state in place. And the thinking was, what could they do? I mean, we thought then could not be transferred to public, I'm sorry, to private ownership. So what are they going to do? Have a lottery? Well, I mean, they did something, right? Because now you have all these oligarchs that are these billionaires. Boy, I mean, to think.
Well, I'll tell a story. I had a high school friend who was the manager of a pig farm near my hometown. He had about 10,000 pigs. He was managing, and when 1989, he became suddenly rich, and I said, well, what did you do? He said, well, you know, I was the manager, so I just changed the papers, and now it's my farm. It was mine anyway before, so now it's mine. So, you know, they managed to make everything extremely easy for the old managerial class to take over the state and divide it between themselves, and then of course then participate in a trade economy where everything went up, and so they became hugely rich. And that was the same thing in Russia. And then Putin chased away the first wave of oligarchs to put in his own, and now in the Ukraine the older style gang of oligarchs is actually fighting Putin's oligarchs and in the process waking up nationalism, that old horror. So there we go.
Yeah, I wonder. 1914. Wonder what sort of pardon me. What sort of cynicism exists? Because the only really formal opposition to the inequities of capitalism, particularly 100 years ago and more, were communism and socialism. And when they were practiced, they turned out to be nothing that people really wanted too much, unless you were cut in on the racket. And that was only a small percentage of the people. And now, I guess it's just what they call the tyranny of the fact, that people are back to their own resources, trying to make it through the best they can. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Soviet experiment half the time, and certainly the entire so-called communist experiment in all the countries under the Soviet influence, well, it was an experiment in actually emptying the words communism and socialism of meaning.
Right.
You know, it was a return to a kind of feudal system where, you know, there are a lot of people worked for a few bosses, and if they didn't like it, they disappeared.
Yeah, they, there was an old saying is that under capitalism, it's dog eat dog, and under communism, just the opposite is true.
Right. Somebody said actually when they just started this business in Romania, they said, well, you know, we want to work like we did in socialism and live like we live in capitalism. Neither one of them was true, because nobody worked back then. They said, well, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us.
You want to hear a Soviet joke? A commissar comes to a collective farm and says to the manager, comrade manager, how goes the crop of corn this year? And he says, comrade commissar, the corn is as high as God's eye. And the commissar says, comrade manager, you know there's no God. And the farmer says, comrade commissar, you know there's no corn.
That's exactly right.
Listen, we're about to wrap up with Andrei Codrescu, and if you've never, you've probably heard him, his commentary on NPR, but his poetry is just amazing, and it's going to occur at the Scarab Club Wednesday, March 19th, coming right up. It's part of the Woodward Line Poetry Series. And his recent books are So Recently Rent a World, New and Selected Poems, 1968 to 2012, The Post-Human Dada Guide, Tsara and Lenin Play Chess. This could have been a whole show. Actually, all of Andre's books could. Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. Reading along with Andre is Leanne Brown and Katie Bohintz. Andre's website, a lot of good stuff there, is Andrei Codrescu, CODRESCU.com. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Andre, do you, when you're selecting, so I mean, how many books, do you have any idea how many books, you ever count them up, how many books of poetry you've published?
No, actually, I don't, but, you know, there are a few.
There are a couple dozens. Yeah. So when you're, you're coming to Detroit, you go, okay, this is cool for Detroit. This one, I'll read that in St. Louis. I mean, is there a specificity? Well, what a terrible word. When you're selecting what you're going to read here?
Well, I mostly use the oracular method. You know, I open the book and see what comes up, but, since I'll be in Detroit, I'll try to read some of the earlier poems that I wrote when I was there, or, you know, close to that time, because I think they have something of the spirit of what was going on.
Well, great. I'm going to look forward to seeing you, of course, and I hope some of our listeners join you as well. Andrei Codrescu has been my guest, as he has so many times before. Andrei, I'll see you in Detroit.
Well, it's great talking to you, Peter, and to keep the conversation going.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
Now your whole family gets even more for less. Sign up for the More Everything plan from Verizon and share an amazing 10 gigabytes of data for just $45 monthly access per line when you sign up for 4 lines with Verizon Edge. Click the banner to learn more. Activation, early termination, and other fees may apply.
The big day is almost here. Baseball opening day, Monday, March 31st. Plan on heading downtown for all of the opening day festivities, but don't want to deal with the hassle of driving or parking? Crosstown Limos has you covered. Reserve a luxury car, limo, or party bus from Crosstown Limos for just $101 with promo code WRIF. Go right now to crosstownlimos.com or call 734-926-LIMO. That's 734-926-LIMO for Crosstown Limos.
Detroit's rock station.
That's great. That's like winning the sweepstakes.
101. The Riff.
I'll try to see your twisted point of view. The jury and the judge already let the gavel fall. Court is out, there's nothing I can do. And there's not a question of belief on your behalf. I think it is your will that brings the doubt. And like a wound that never leaves, infected from within, I won't survive if I don't believe you have.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
High fidelity stereophonic sound.
Everything that rocks.